You've been listening to The Core on the Envision Radio Network, copyright 2014.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know.
Revolution starts now.
This is Night Call, Detroit's longest running phone in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF.
That's 248-544-9743.
Or text the riff at 4WRIF.
That's 49743.
Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Julene Jordan is off tonight, and a wonderful excuse. It's her birthday. So happy birthday, Julene. I'm sure you're listening right now to every word that I'm saying. But if you'd like to wish Julene a happy birthday, you can go to her Facebook page. And I think you Facebookers, of which I am not one, although we have a Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. You could probably, can't you do that? Post greetings there. You can say happy birthday, Julene. She has her own Facebook page as well. I guess you can find that. Or you can just send birthday greetings to her at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Also, I'll be getting your comments there as well. Boy, it always feels lonely here. It's me and Jefferson's in the other room taking your calls at 248-544-WRIF. And this is where Jolene says, 248-544-9743. So we can make it less lonely if you join us. And what we do is, it's not we, is it? It's me. But it's you, too. So that's the we. So we talk about stuff. I introduce subjects, but you can do it as well. Just pick up the phone, 248-544-WRIF. Yeah, I wonder what the percentage of people are that are paying attention to what's happening in Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula that looks like it's going to revert back to Russia, and President Obama has his shorts all in an uproar about it, saying it violates international law, and I don't know. Yeah, it's so mixed. There used to be, like, good guys and bad guys, and now there's kind of good guys on both sides and bad guys on both sides. So I think that what it really means is a lot of people just sit back and kind of think, oh, man, crazy people are at it again. Because that ultra-nationalism, both on the parts of that far right, what's called the right sector, in fact, that were the street fighters in Kiev that overthrew the Ukrainian government, are pretty bad news guys. And on the other hand, Putin, whoa, what a piece of work that guy is. And you have these ultra-nationalists, these Russians that don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. And it is so complicated. I mean, I'm not even going to try to unpack it, as they say these days. I'm not even going to try to unpack it unless you want to bring up stuff about it. And you can do that at 248-544-WRIF. Lots of other subjects as well. So if you're thinking, Ukraine, man, I don't even care. Bring up something else. I'm going to bring up lots of other stuff as well. But one of the important things really to look at is, and the concern of Russia is, regardless of what we think of Putin, regardless of what we think of his authoritarian nature and as critical as we should be of his government and a lot of these laws and what have you, this is all about the West moving east. It is about the West moving east again. It is about Europe and the United States reinvigorating the Cold War again. President Obama talks about Russia meddling in Crimea. Russia meddling in Crimea. This is a semi-autonomous province of Ukraine that for some reason or other was ceded to Ukraine. I mean, it's attached to it, to Ukraine, by Stalin back in 1954. But it's made up of Russian-speaking people. And one of the first things that this new Kiev government did that's out in the West that wants to link up with the West, is to repeal this multi-language law that made the law had Russian as being one of the official languages. Now it isn't. And they also repealed a law against neo-Nazi propaganda because some of these groups that are these street fighters in Kiev, they're tied into these pro-Nazi groups that fought with the Nazis during World War II, heavily anti-Semitic. So, what are we to make of all this? On the other hand, you got these tuzzers, you know, these guys with the whips that are whipping people and all. Oh, man, what a mess. I mean, we certainly should not be involved in it. You know, the U.S. is always fighting these battles thousands of miles away from our borders and accusing, as I said, President Obama accusing Russia of meddling in Crimea. I mean, who's meddling? What business is it of ours? I mean, there is international law, so I'm not trying to say it's not the business of the international community, but it's not the United States world cop to say this or that or to warn Russia, because what that does, it sets the political and even the cultural context here in the United States for the United States intervening anywhere and everywhere in the world that it chooses. It justifies hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of overseas bases of our fortune, our national fortune, our natural, national wealth of being expended on the military rather than taking care of everything here. Let's see, what do we have here? The Pentagon took its first military steps since the crisis erupted to reassure Eastern European NATO members. Now get this. Eastern European NATO members. Does that send up any flags? Well, NATO has become sort of like a proper noun of this military alliance, but it's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So why are they currently policing the airspace of the Baltic nations? I mean, they're up there, to be sure. And a program to carry out joint training with Poland's Air Force will also be expanded. Look at what's happening in the city of Detroit. How much money we need. Anybody go downtown regularly like I do and got to go by these regions where there's not even streetlights? Wait, weren't we talking about Ukraine here? Yeah, there's not money for streetlights, yet there's anybody, I have no idea, but do you know how many tens of millions must be expended probably preparing for and participating a joint training with Poland's Air Force? Now, why would we be doing that? What would Russia view this as its purpose? Training troops and military of people on the border of its country. I always use this analogy. What would we be doing if China was doing joint exercises with Mexico or, hey, Venezuela or some, you know, Mexico or something like that? I think we'd be a little upset. There's something called the Monroe Doctrine that says, hey, you can't even come in our hemisphere, European powers. You better stay out. This is our deal right here. You can't come in and mess with the geopolitical situation here in the Western Hemisphere, either North America or Central America or South America. Nobody's done that. When? Wasn't that like Napoleon III? And what was that guy? He sent over this guy Maximilian to Mexico. When was it? Like 1850s or something? And since then, nobody, it is verboten, cannot do. In fact, one of the things that led to World War I, at least one of the phony excuses, I always love to do this, why did we enter World War I? I need some crickets back here. Well, one of the reasons was something called the Zimmerman Note, where the fort, and this is not George, maybe one of his ancestors. The foreign minister of Germany, of the Kaiser's Germany, wrote a note, a Zimmerman note, to Mexico saying, in the case of war between the United States and Germany, if Mexico entered the war on the side of Germany, that they would grant, if there was a German victory, they would grant Mexico the lands that were, depends on how you look at it, stolen or conquered from Mexico, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, California, all that. So we don't like that, yet the idea that we can put up missile shields in the middle of Europe that are clearly aimed at Russia. So the idea that Putin is not real happy with what's going on separate from what kind of deal he's running is quite understandable. And the people of Ukraine, on the other hand, you could think, well, wait a minute. Do I want to be associated with Germany or do I want to be associated with Russia? That doesn't seem like real rocket science, does it? You go, let me see. Russia, they've got Putin. Standard living's not so great. More and more authoritarian. All these crazy nationalists and insane homophobes running around. Yeah, I'm gonna go with Germany. And that was the whole thing that began this. Is Western Ukraine was angry because the president of Ukraine was going to sign this big trade deal, or women. I can't remember which way it went. Either it was they were not going to sign a big trade deal with Western Europe, or they were going to sign a big trade deal with Russia. I'm getting lost in all the details. But anyways, it was something mad, and suddenly, you know, they're street fighting, right? Turns out, though, this president of Ukraine was just corrupt as the day is long and getting more and more authoritarian, so nobody was really too sorry to see him go. But here's what, let me read through this one piece here. I've got exclamation points on it, so that usually means there's something of some importance. By the way, 248-544-WRIF. I'm not even sure what you can comment on this, but feel free to do so if you'd like. Here, the offer came atop $1 billion in American loan guarantees to ease Ukraine's economic transition. They're sending them $1 billion, and Detroit can't get... Wait, let me back up with the correct pronoun. We're specifically, not the U.S. government, we, you and I, anybody paying taxes, us, if you're working, your parents, you know, if you're like in high school, whatever, $1 billion in American loan guarantees to ease Ukraine's economic transition. To what? I don't know. The offer of loans are crucial because Ukraine is in dire economic shape with a promised Russian loan of $15 billion in abeyance since the ouster of President Yanukovych. And with Russia's decision to cancel a large discount on gas supplies to Ukraine. Ukrainian officials said they need $35 billion in new loans and credits over the next 2 years to avoid default. Okay, here's where it comes in, and here is the mirror in Detroit. A team from the International Monetary Fund, that's called the IMF, was in Kiev, that's the capital out in the west of Ukraine, where the overthrow of the government took place, to study the books and consider a loan. They are studying the books and considering a loan. Well, that's nice, you know, if you're into the chess game of, the big game and all that. Oh, yeah. But here's Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Reagan. I'm quoting like a Reaganoid. According to the Kommersant Ukraine, the finance ministry of Washington, this guy isn't pulling any stooges in Kiev, so he doesn't like these, who are pretending to be a government, has prepared an economic austerity plan that will cut Ukrainian pensions from $160 to $80 so that Western bankers who loan money to Ukraine can be repaid at the expense of Ukraine's poor. It is Greece all over again, he says. Before anything approaching stability and legitimacy has been obtained for the puppet government put in power by the Washington-orchestrated coup against the legitimate elected Ukraine government, the Western looters are at work. Now, it was a legitimate and elected Ukraine government, and there was going to be elections, okay? Same thing with these right-wingers in Venezuela that are trying to overthrow the Maduro government. I mean, a lot of problems with that Bolivarian revolutionary government. And if you don't like the guy, vote him out. Don't, initiate all this violence. But Paul Craig Roberts says naive protesters who believe the propaganda that the European Union membership offered a better life are due to lose half of their pension by April. He says this is only the beginning. The corrupt Western media describes loans as aid. However, the 11 billion euros that the EU is offering Kiev is not aid. It is a loan. Moreover, it comes with many strings, including Kiev's acceptance of an IMF austerity plan. So these rich Western bankers come into countries that are doing poorly. It's like happens here, like Detroit or any number of other cities or people in general. And they say, okay, we're going to loan you all this money to get over, but you've got to cut city services, you've got to lay off people, you've got to cut pensions. Sound familiar? let's see. The austerity plan will cut social services, funds for education, lay off government workers, devalue the currency, thus raising the price of imports, which will include Russian gas and electricity, and open Ukrainian assets to take over by Western corporations. So there it goes. That's part of what it's all about. And there's a lot more. But I'd like to hear from you. A couple of you want to talk about that. I was surprised. I didn't think anybody wanted to talk about Ukraine, but I wanted to have my say. I'm Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, off for her birthday today. You can call me at 248-544-WRIF, Jefferson, waiting for your calls. A couple of people waiting, a couple open lines as well. Let's see what Tim in Lincoln Park has to say. Tim, hi, it's Peter. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Pete. Well, first of all, happy birthday to Jolene.
Yeah, for sure.
She's having a good time. Well, you pretty much said everything I kind of called about. I mean, this whole business about Ukraine going with the EU, and of course, what sparked off the protesters was this would-be agreement between Ukraine and the EU. It was called an association agreement, but this was sort of the door to bring Ukraine into full membership of the EU. But the price was what you just said. It was a big austerity plan.
No, that's right. Yukanovich canceled it. Right.
Yeah, he did, because, look, I mean, both sides are about playing very strong-arm politics. I mean, obviously, Putin said, look, if you go with this association agreement, then we're going to cut off basically the Eurasian Customs Agreement, which is this sort of it's sort of analogous to the EU, but not exactly. They wouldn't have an austerity plan for the Ukrainians, but you would have a large amounts of so-called free trade of gas and so on, and you'd have a putative, borderless passage of the people in that union. This would include Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Russia, Ukraine, several other countries. So to put it very simply, there was more money up front for Yanukovych if he agreed with Putin. So he did. So the protesters, who are mostly Western-based in the Ukraine, that's a very complicated country, by the way.
Sure.
You know, it's composed of Western Ukrainian Catholics, Eastern Ukrainian Orthodox. There are Russian speakers, both of Russian origin, Ukrainian origin, in southern Ukraine. Then there are the Tatars, who were deported by Stalin in the 40s. And then, as a concession to the Ukraine, Khrushchev in 54 gave Crimea to Ukraine, which historically Crimea was part of Russia. Of course, we have to keep in mind that all these countries, Russia, the U.S., they're all imperialist in nature. So when we talk about their territory, it's at someone else's expense, right? So to boil it down, I mean, the American media has done a poor job in educating the public and on who's really right here. I mean,
no, that's for sure. You know, one thing, Tim, that surprised me, though, that this referendum, the Crimean Parliament passed a secession bill, and now it's going to come up from referendum. But the logic was that Putin wanted a million Russian speakers sympathetic to Russia in the Ukraine Federation. So who knows? I don't know whether they're going to reintegrate, whether even Russia will say, yeah, okay, we'll take you back. I mean, what would...
I guess the only thing, I mean, I see Crimea as a sort of a done deal, even if it's not officially annexed by Russia. I think with this referendum probably will probably support Crimea's at least association with Russia. So you may not see a full integration with Russia, but I think you'll see Crimea strongly allied with Russia. And I think the West will just have to lump it because,
well,
you know, what's the alternative?
Yeah. Yeah, but lumping it is not the problem. The problem is, why is the West, again, at the doorstep of Russia? Why do we see as, quote, our interest, including military ones, so far from our home? I mean, just like Stalin, who wanted peace with the West, and anybody disputes that, please call me at 248-544-WRIF. This was not a guy as awful, one of the most vile dictators, maybe the most vile dictator that's ever existed in history, was still just into consolidating power in that region and wanted a recognition of mutual empires. He understood that the United States had a worldwide empire, and he wanted to keep the Soviet Empire and its Eastern European buffer states intact to as a guarantee for security. And same with Putin. Putin's not moving west. He has no, it's what Tim just said. I mean, they want this federation of these former Soviet republics, but it certainly doesn't have plans to take over Poland or Germany or anything like that, where the United States and the EU are right at the doorstep of Russia again. All right, Tim, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Okay.
Okay, he says. All right. Here is Chief. Chief is in Detroit. Chief, hey, you're on the air. What's up?
This whole Russia and the U.S. thing just doesn't sit right with me. You know, I feel like another World War III is going to come out of it.
Another? I hope we. You mean World War III?
I mean another World War. You know.
Yeah,
World
yeah. III, I know. Yeah. I was only joshing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, it's, you know, where did it all start? World War I in this little country, you know, with an assassination and just blew up. I mean, we would do well to disengage, we being the United States. I don't know what the hell we're doing over there. If there is a breach of international law, that should be brought in front of the United Nations. I mean, there's nothing the United States can do anyway. I mean, the conservatives now are going all crazy and saying, see, that's why we don't need a cut in our army. So what are we going to do? Send all 3,000 of these tanks that are sitting in Arizona or something like that and send them off to Europe?
Is why do we keep having to bail out other countries all the time? I mean...
Well, I agree. Why don't we bail out our country?
I know, right? I mean, we're thinking more for them than to our own people. I mean...
Well, I don't think there's a concern for them in the slightest. I mean, that's sort of the rhetoric. It is, when we talk about our interests, it's usually like in the Middle East, it's oil and there's oil involved here as well, in Ukraine. But, it's almost reflexive. I mean, the United States has this addiction to interfering in everybody's business across the world. And it's cost us trillions of dollars in money that could have been spent elsewhere, like here in our area. It could have meant that we would have been not have had slums, that we wouldn't have had potholes, like just ruined a wheel and a tire of mine. All right. Thank you very much, Chief. I agree with you completely. By the way, I am surprised and pleased that you want to talk about Ukraine, and going to continue to do it as long as you're calling 248-544-WRIF. But I have something. They just did this this big research survey, the Pew Research Center, and they did this big study on what they call millennials. Isn't that, and, you know, you get this big label if you're between 18 and 33, and the results are, well, actually, they're not that surprising to me, but I'm going to tell you about those a little later. We'll continue. We'll keep talking about this Ukraine thing. But let's go out to Kevin in Chelsea. Kevin, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Jim. No problem. I think it's really cool you guys are talking about a current event like this.
Good, sure. You too. Go ahead.
Started World War II, not directly after World War I was over. I don't remember the years. Exactly. It's been a couple of years out of school. But I remember Hitler justified taking over a few regions adjacent to Germany that he owned them pre-World War I or during World War I, that they should be his. And that seems what Putin's doing. And that escalated pretty quickly back then, so I don't know what's going to happen now.
Well, that was sort of what they go, but the Sudetenland and Austria and all that. I mean, I got to tell you, is that nobody was threatening Hitler, and Putin and the Russians feel very threatened, and the fact that there's the United States and Europe financially and militarily are right up against Russia's door kind of is a different situation. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, I don't really have much more to add.
Okay, well, good, good. Sounds like you're having fun someplace, but I'm glad you're listening. Here is Jesse. Jesse's in Detroit. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Jesse. Are you at the same place that the last guy was?
No, this is Kathy.
Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
How are you? Yeah, I'm from Detroit also, West Side. I just wanted to say that our country is literally borderline the next civil war. We've already got police overstepping their boundaries with civilians, doing stuff they haven't done in the past. politicians are already doing a lot of corrupt stuff, and most people I've been talking to politics-wise, they've been thinking this country is either going for Civil War II or World War III at this rate.
Well, you know, a lot of people are kind of pissed off and what have you, but we're certainly not at the level that things were right before before the Civil War. And you would think a lot of these Republicans and these conservatives go so crazy over stuff like Obamacare, but there's nothing that that's a minor blip in the economy compared to, for instance, slavery, which was the basis of the Southern economy and their political and economic dominance. And I mean, that's the whole reason they joined those Southern states, those slave states. That's the whole reason that they joined the rebellion against England in the first place. They thought England was going to abolish slavery, which it eventually did, not too far down the line from 1776. And that's why they wanted to make sure that there was a Second Amendment so they could have militias to chase down slaves. And when they thought there was even a chance of a president coming who was not committed to abolishing slavery, Lincoln, they said, okay, we're out of here. We're going to protect our institution of slavery even if we have to bust apart the United States. So that's why I never understand why any of these guys fly the Confederate flag. Biggest traitors in American history that are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans, including some Johnny Reb who shot my great-great-grandpappy. All right, thank you, Kathy. I got to take a break, and we'll be right back. Ever drink on Belle Isle? I have. I'll tell you the details, the dirty details. We come back. Also, I'll give you the results of that fascinating new survey by the Pew Research Center about the millennials. That's you if you're between 18 and 33. That's what they're calling you, whether you like the label or not.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend brought to you by Planet Fitness. Join Planet Fitness for just $10 a month with no commitments. Relax, get in shape, and have fun in their judgment-free zones. Sign up at the club or at planetfitness.com. The
Rick. Geico presents Strange Savings Stories. Ken Marcus was making a pastrami sandwich when he noticed an odd pattern on a slice of pumpernickel bread. One that spelled out Geico. Ken found himself visiting Geico.com, saving hundreds of dollars on car insurance with great discounts. Later, Ken felt conflicted whether or not he should eat the slice of bread that saved him so much money. But he was so hungry.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
If you've got 15 seconds, Geico could help you be a better driver.
In the average city, drivers run red lights 120,000 times a day. There are two basic types of red light runners. There's the daydreamer, and there's the accelerator who speeds up on the yellow. Are we really in that much of a hurry? The typical speed through an intersection is over 50 miles per hour. Be careful around intersections. If you get a yellow light, stop. If you have the green light, watch for the red light runner.
Manage your policy, get roadside assistance, and more. Just a tap away on Geico's free mobile app.
This is your Car Care Minute. Email, texting, and Twitter are some of today's communication tools. But when it comes to vehicle repair or service, a face-to-face meeting with your automotive technician is still the best method of communication to ensure a satisfactory service. But do your homework before taking your vehicle in for repairs or service. Read your owner's manual. Make a written list of your vehicle's dashboard warning signals or changes in performance and handling. Go through your list with the technician or service consultant. Let them diagnose and recommend a remedy. But do ask questions regarding the costs before work begins. Two-way communication. It's the key to better automotive service. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com. This is your Car Care Minute. Drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com. This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
101 WRIF. Oh.
Sanctuary of HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Jalene.
All right, thank you very much. Jalene is off. It's her birthday. Happy birthday, Jalene. I'm sure you're listening. 248-544-WRIF and 248-544-9743. My personal website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, is there for you. Also, Facebook.com/nightcall. And Kim wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Tried to rip me a new one. I'm going to get to that. I want to do what I promised. This is an absolutely great message. But what was it? Oh, yeah, drinking on Belle Isle. He was talking about Kim's message, email message, is about some personal stuff I said, so this will add to it. Now, you know Belle Isle is now a state park, but police are warning visitors on Belle Isle to leave the booze at the bridge with the spring thaw coming. This is from CBS News. People are now gearing up for parties and picnics at the now Michigan State Park, but this summer police are advising people to keep the alcohol off the island or else. It's against state law. I mean, are you serious? I mean, I play handball out there. You guys know. I don't know. Does everybody know what handball is? It's like racquetball, except you play with gloves and you don't use a racket. You got to play ambidextrously, too. It's a hard game. Fun. Anyway, there's a whole culture of handball and racquetball out at Belle Isle. And what do you think is in those chests, those ice chests in the summer? Are they really going to bust all these people doing that? This is out of control. Bad behavior is not going to be tolerated, said Michigan State Police Lieutenant Phil Mena. The only difference now, it always has been that, but he says it's going to actually be enforced. Officers on patrol will stop and issue tickets to anyone consuming alcohol on the island, but you can get a permit to do it. However, Ron Olson, Chief of Parks and Recreation for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, oh, he's calling off the dogs, said there won't be extreme enforcement of the no alcohol policy. Well, gee, I wonder who they're going to enforce it against and who they aren't. A bunch of white middle-aged guys playing handball or a bunch of young black kids, young people. I mean, over, say, early 20s. Well, oh, I'm always feeling race into it, aren't I? Anyway, it's probably not the case. All right, I'm going to get to Kim's letter accusing me of being a slacker. I mean, I'll admit to that. I don't even accuse me. But there's a new study by the Pew Research Center that finds that the millennials, do you object to being called a millennial between 18 and 33? And it says you folks are drifting away from the traditional institutions, political ones, religious ones, and cultural. Half of millennials now describe themselves as political independents, and almost 30% are not affiliated with any religion, numbers that are at or near the highest levels of political and religious disaffiliation recorded for any generation in the last quarter century. And I usually think people lie anyways about religion, because even, you know, it's a poll. They don't take your name and address. But you remember, I think we've probably talked about this, is that people always, you go to church? Oh, yeah, I go every Sunday. You know, right. And turns out they don't. Sometimes they even think they do. Millennials are the first in the modern era to have high levels of student loan debt, poverty and unemployment, and lower levels of wealth and personal income than their two immediate predecessor generations had at the same age. Younger people in general are less likely to say they are patriotic or religious, but the gap, talks about the millennials and Generation Xers, but forget about that. Millennials also are far more likely than any other generation to say they are supporters of gay rights, and the big gay rights trial here in Detroit that just ended on Friday, where obviously this patently unconstitutional amendment in the Michigan Constitution says that got to be a man and woman to be married. So that's going to be out of there. Although half of millennials describe themselves as independent, 57% say their views on social issues have become more liberal over the course of their lives. This is in direct opposition to older generations, who Pew says have about half or more of the group saying their social views have become more conservative. One might argue that millennials simply haven't lived long enough to hit the triggers that might engender more conservatism, marriage, family, and mortgages. I don't know. Or it could be that this group of young people is fundamentally different. I never got more conservative. I have got married. I have a mortgage. I have a wife. Is that a family? I think it means with kids as well. 10 years ago, 24% of millennials identified as Republicans, but now it's down to a paltry 17%. In other words, if you're a young Republican, you are a weirdo. It's okay. Don't let that stop you. A lot of my views have been called a weirdo for. Millennials were the sole generation in which a majority supported bigger government with more services as opposed to smaller government with fewer services. Huh. Okay, that ties into Kim, who wrote this note into, I love this, into Call Talk, yes. Yeah, isn't that crazy? Someone really trying to hurt you? And I love it. I mean, maybe I'll even post it. Anyway, I just wanted to comment, says Kim, on your comment last week that life should be easy. What I said was that life should not have to be hard. There's enough here from all of us. But we got these hogs in the middle of the stream that aren't letting everybody have access to clean, cool water. That's metaphoric. I'm waxing eloquent. Well, maybe not. But anyway, and we'll get to that about the billionaires. We're talking about people on one hand that are fighting to get $10.10 an hour where other people are. I'll get to that part of it later. And he says, that's typical, coming from a liberal mindset like yours. I don't know. What does he think? Life should be hard? He said, you admitted that you graduated high school at the age of 20 and was a slacker in high school and you never finished college. That's true. You were too busy drinking. This guy is like hanging on every word of mine. You were too busy drinking and playing pool on your parents' dime, by the way. Did I say my parents were paying for it? I did play a lot of pool. And I did do a lot of drinking. And I'm sure they really appreciated that. They did not. Your sarcasm was right on. You know, there was a lot of tension in the family there because I was supposed to be becoming a lawyer, not hanging out at the Michigan State Union pool room and, pushing a lot of cue. You admit you're lazy, not ambitious, and lack initiative. Now, okay, that's me. But now here's where he's probably, unless he's older. And maybe it's a she, Kim, that could be, I know, Kims that are men and Kims that are women. But he said, you admit you're lazy, not ambitious, and lack initiative like most liberals. Uh-huh. Like most liberals are lazy, not ambitious, and lack initiative. Is that your experience? I don't know. Most liberals I know are pretty ambitious and don't lack initiative. I do, but he says, however, you got lucky and somehow got that job you have. Now, it's not entirely luck. You know, if you're like me and you're white working class or white poor or rural poor, you're not going to wind up with this job. If you're African American and you're working class and you're poor and you don't have initiative and you're not ambitious, you're going to be in a world of trouble. You don't wind up like me. This is class privilege. This is race privilege that got me where I am. Because if you were down far, if someone like me is down further on the economic and class scale, you know, you're in bad shape. Where is this? He says, most of the other lazy liberals that take advantage of their parents and never finish college go on welfare and collect food stamps. This is idiotic. I don't know. I'm trying to think about the other lazy liberals. I do know a few lazy liberals. A lot of us are lazy radicals, though. You know, I mean, beyond that, we're not just liberals. But, back then, you know, when I went to college, you didn't run up this huge debt. I mean, this is part of the problem. That young people are saddled with this enormous debt, whereas college should be free. Taking it all from the war budget and don't have our kids coming out of college with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, sometimes $100,000 in debt. If that would have been the case, I would never have gone to college, right? I mean, my parents couldn't have afforded it and I couldn't have afforded it. But see what he's doing and if you, there's always a subtext to these right wingers. This 17%. I'm going to somehow assume that this Kim is a millennial between 18 and 33. But Kim, I wrote you and said I was going to read it. So tell me whether you're a man or woman and what your age is. So you've been a slacker your whole life, and you sit there week after week complaining about the wealthy that more than likely finish college and work their butts off to make their money. Not all of them, but I do believe a lot of them earn their money. Well, there are so many subtexts in this thing, I don't even know what to say. Probably the worst part of it is, I mean, forget about it. He's an apologist for the ultra-wealthy that just get wealthier and wealthier while the middle class gets screwed, the working class and the poor get poorer and poorer. And he can't understand that, but I'll deal with that in just a minute. Hey, if you want to get in on this conversation and talk about it all, 248-544-WRIF. Let me talk about the subtext first, and then I'll just talk a minute about me. This is a rationalization, a rationale for why we would deny people that are getting increasingly hurt by a system that is so unfair and so unequal that we can deny them food stamps and unemployment, extended unemployment benefits and all that. The system works absolutely wonderful for like the top 20% of the people, and of course the 1% and the 0.1% at the top. But this is the rationale for denying them. And it's this punitive spirit. It's this mean-spiritedness that infects this sector of the political spectrum. But he says about the wealthy, I do believe a lot of them earn their money. I'm not even sure what that phrase means. Bill Gates, who once again is the wealthiest man in the world, is worth about $76 billion. He earned his money. I'm not even sure what that exactly means. Under our system, he can accumulate the most obscene amount of wealth. Oh, go ahead. Let me take off the adjective. He can accumulate the most amount of wealth that's possible. And he gives back some. He gives back tens of millions of dollars, which amounts to about pocket change, almost rounding. You know what I mean? If you've got like 98 cents, you round it off to a dollar. If he gave away $200-300 million, that's just a rounding figure for $76 billion. It's nothing. It's pocket change. I don't even know. He probably couldn't give it away. What would you do? Say he's going to say, look, nobody needs more than a billion, right? So I'm going to give away $75 billion. What am I going to do? Where would he even put it? But, me. One thing is I exaggerate. I partly exaggerate to show the privilege that accrues to people and that the ease of which some people can make it through life and other people find it extraordinarily difficult who don't have advantages of race or class or other or gender or what have you. Why do I have to be ambitious? I don't have kids. If I had children, I probably would have had to been real ambitious. I wouldn't even be here. I'd have a nationally syndicated talk show like I've had at different times. And you know what? I hate to say it. It made my life miserable. I didn't like doing it. I like doing this once a week. And I do the other stuff on WRIF and WCSX and 105.1, Sports 105.1 in our HD stations. I like that. Yeah, I like doing that. And that gives me a nice modest income. And I don't have to be 24/7, which you have to do when you're doing this. And then I could have is this arrogance? I was doing pretty well, I think, at these syndicated shows and well thought of. And I probably could have become wealthy. Well, I don't know. I think I'm affluent now, which means I have pretty much everything I want, which is pretty modest, right? I have a little house. I have a little car. Actually, not just a little car. Got a good sound system, can go places. I can't go to these real fancy resorts. I don't get to hang out with the ultra wealthy, who I wouldn't want to anyways. I don't like them. I mean, I know some people that are wealthy and I like them. But anyway, forget about me. I was exaggerating a little that I was not, I'm not ambitious and I don't have initiative to go anywhere beyond where I am, but I'm not lazy. I am not lazy. I work like hell to do what I have to do in the things that I want to accomplish, this program being one of them, for instance. But, okay, enough of that. Oh, well, let me see. I should go back. I just haven't even checked our phones. Any thoughts about that? Hey, millennials, 18 to 33, what do you think? Does that typify you folks? I sort of lost. Where did I do with that? Oh, here it is. Yeah. Millennials now, political independence, not affiliated with any religion, the highest level, 30%, and I think it's more than that. Not patriotic, what else? 17% of millennials, 18 to 33, identify with the Republican Party. Why don't they just go home? You know, these right-wingers had this big thing they put together every year. What's it called? The Conservative Political Action Conference. Very frightening, of course. But any of you know this Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann? I mean, she makes so many gaffes. And actually, I read this wrong. But she said, don't forget, we are the party, the Republicans, the only party that had a woman on the presidential ticket this century. And I kind of neglected the last phrase, this century, because she was talking about Sarah Palin. Well, they didn't have one in 2000. They didn't have one in 2004. And they didn't have one in 2012. And the Democrats in 1984 had a woman as a presidential candidate, Geraldine Ferraro, who ran a pretty bad campaign with Walter Mondale, lost badly. But, you know, there's something about these conservatives, isn't there? They're always insulting people about their economic status, about their race, about their sexual preference. What is with these folks? I mean, they're just such bad news. You know, they, I don't know. All right, let's, boy, I haven't had any calls about this in a long time. Here's Jimmy in Roseville. Jimmy, thanks for calling 313. Nope, wrong one. 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, I win those Motley Crue tickets, man.
No.
I'm just kidding.
I know.
Yeah, so, I think medical marijuana or even marijuana in general would be amazing for the world's economy. In sales tax, I mean, you could have mom and pop shops of it even. It would just supply the world with income and fabrics and many different things.
You know what, Jimmy? It's happening out in some of those western states. Colorado has taken in millions of dollars in tax money. You know what's going to be interesting? To see what the effect, I mean, having more stoners kind of walking around. But, you know, don't you think people, I mean, even though marijuana has been illegal, people probably self-regulate, don't they? You know what I mean? They don't.
Many people.
Yeah, but one of the things I tell people, I know, I can't remember the list. I mean, maybe I can reconstruct it. But lawyers, judges, police, professional photographers, stoners, people that are stoned all the time that smoke 3, 4, 5. Well, you don't have to smoke that much anymore. But are really, you know, to use the more conventional term, high all the time. And it's probably, and somebody that maybe that does that can call us and tell us, but it's what they call self-medicating, is that it has the effect of putting their brain in the place where they want it to be. And it doesn't seem to affect them. I mean, we always talk. I don't want my airplane pilot or, you know, the drivers coming the other way to be stoned, but I'll bet you a lot of them are, huh?
Yeah, many people of all different types do it. I happen to know a lawyer who actually does it and solves murder cases.
Wayne County.
So.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It's an experiment. If things would have been a lot better if these crazoids, the same ones that put in alcohol prohibition, if they hadn't put in this prohibition against marijuana and other drugs, probably. I mean, I don't understand it, how you make a criminal out of somebody who, like, if you think it's bad for people, right? It's harmful. That's what they say. They've put millions of people in jail, some for just smoking marijuana, which is not harmful to people medically, and spent $1 trillion on the war on drugs. Drugs, they always say, more plentiful, more potent than ever. So it's a catastrophic failure, except this was more, we talked about the military industrial complex. What would this be? The war on drugs was partly the prison industrial complex, so that we got all these clients to, you know, put in prison, and that took public money. I mean, it's just been a total disaster. So everything is out of whack. Everything's out of balance. And so now we're going to see what happens when suddenly we can say, okay, we can all get high. We'll see. All right, Jimmy, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Dan. Dan is in Detroit. Dan, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Peter. How are you doing today?
We're doing good. When I say we, it's just me. Hi. Jalene's not here.
Yeah. Well, I was just listening to you guys, and you, Peter, sorry. And I'm a millennial. I'm white, 30, and male.
Okay.
And that letter, yes and no.
It just what? Say it again. I'm sorry. I didn't hear you.
Yes and no.
Oh, some yes and it, no. Okay. Yeah.
Some of it, yes. Yeah, some of it, no, not at all. As far as my political views, I don't consider myself liberal. I don't consider myself Republican. I think that they're more, they're just going with how everybody else is going. And as far as I'm concerned, there's not many of them that are worth anything, but that's neither here nor there.
But no, it is. Actually, I didn't read everything, but that, I mean, the majority of millennials say that there's not very much difference between the political parties. So you're right there with it. Go ahead.
But I consider myself more American.
Yeah.
There's things that the Democrats do that I actually agree with and it should be that way. And there's things that the Republicans do that I agree with and it should be that way. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Okay.
Not so much left or right, definitively. As far as our religious views, I don't go to church every Sunday. My job that I have, my schedule wouldn't allow it anyway. But I do believe that there's something higher, a higher power. There's things that I've seen in my life that I just can't explain with logic. So that's how I associate it with. So, yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, that's good. And so far, Dan, you're the only millennial that called. I'll repeat all of that, and maybe we can get some more responses. But thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too. All right. I want to, okay, let me see. I'm just looking at the time. Jeff from Pennsylvania is on the air, but if I take you, Jeff, you're going to get about a minute. So if you can hold on for about another 3-4 minutes, we'll get you on the air. We'll talk more about this study that says millennials are less religious, less patriotic, not affiliated with any of the political parties, hardly any of them with the Republicans, and also want to talk about Bill Gates, number one. We'll be back right after these.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Listen up, everybody. This is Flo with a Progressive Insurance Alert. Don't even try to change that channel. I'm on all of them. So, you already know Snapshot rewards our customers for their good driving. Well, now anyone can test drive Snapshot for free, even if you have insurance with another company. See how much you could save before you switch your insurance. Also, I'm offering kazoo lessons on Saturdays.
Test drive Snapshot today. Visit progressive.com/snapshot. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Snapshot not available in all states.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, Here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
Join WRIS Dave and Chuck the Freak for a St. Patrick's Day live broadcast from Dooley's on Gratiot in Roseville. Doors open 6 a.m. Green beer, huge tent, Irish food, and entertainment. Dooley's, Gratiot, north of 13 Mile in Roseville. Details at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Every hour is happy hour.
Everything that rocks.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Thank you very much. Jalene is off tonight. Actually, it's her birthday for another 30 seconds, so happy birthday, Jalene. She'll probably listen to the podcast. You'll be able to listen to the podcast either on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or on the WRIF website as well. Boing! One of those things just popped right out of my brain, too. Boy, I wanted to tell you something. Anyway, Brian, who is a medical marijuana patient, called in to say that medical marijuana helped him through his illness. Yeah, a lot of people are having incredibly good results from that. We're talking about this study from the Pew Research Center that, that says millennials, that is, folks 18 to 33, are drifting away from traditional political, religious, and cultural institutions like the parties. Only 17% of millennials identify with the Republicans. About twice that much do with the Democrats. And most of the views are consistent with Democratic Party views, or liberal views, of course. People, less millennials are religious than any generation before in recent history, and cultural as well. So I'm just wondering whether that typifies you or your, and you could be the parent of a millennial, or if you are a millennial, is that you? Our Dan called from Detroit and said, well, it was sort of mixed. 248-544-WRIF, 248-544-9743. Oh, yeah, I remember what I was going to say, finally. That thing we play at midnight Eastern time every Sunday, which says, are you ready to testify? I'll give you a testimonial. That was recorded live ages ago at the old Grandy Ballroom, where all the great classic rockers of the late 60s and early 70s played. And one of the ways, there wasn't an internet, there wasn't Facebook or anything like that. Now, millennials also are what they call digital natives. You grew up with cell phones and all the electronics and all that. You didn't have to learn it. You didn't have to adapt to it. But back in the day, there were leaflets. People would put leaflets up on telephone poles. I don't even know if they still do this. There's telephone poles that maybe have like, maybe they've taken them down now, but remember, you used to see around Wayne State University, it would probably have 5,000 staples in them, where people had stapled up a leaflet. Anyway, for the Grandy Ballroom and other ballrooms around the country, but centered here in Detroit, were some of the most fabulous poster artists, led by the late Gary Grimshaw, who passed away just recently. Another one still with us, Carl Lundgren, and also a guy named Mouse, who did album covers for, with the Grateful Dead, and they do one for Journey even. I don't know. Anyway, there's going to be a tribute to Carl. Carl Lundgren is drawing the poster for this tribute to the late Gary Grimshaw. It's going to be on, Let me see. It's Saturday, March 22nd. Am I right? Is that the date? I don't even have a calendar in front of me. Does that turn out to be... What's the date today? Today is... the 8th, 15th, 22nd. Yeah. Saturday, March 22nd at New York, New York, in the Premier Center. It's a club called New York, New York. Doug Bodell, for a long time broadcasting on WRIF, now on WCSX. And he's put together this incredible recognition and tribute to Gary Grimshaw and has got this rock memorabilia. Anybody's into that? The stuff he's gotten from the rockers that have contributed, it's absolutely fantastic. So how does the Grandy Ballroom get in all of this? Well, there's going to be a showing of a film about the history of the Grandy Ballroom, which you get to see this old footage of rockers of another era, and they were rocking. I saw the film. It's a great film. Anyway, there's more of that. I don't know. It's probably disappeared a little down my Facebook page. I'll get another post of that. But it's at facebook.com/nightcall, or you can go to Doug Podell, find his Facebook page, and that'll give you the information as well. All right. We promised that we'd go to Pennsylvania and talk to Jeff. Jeff, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
We're good. Where? I forgot. I keep thinking Jalene's here. I'm doing good.
Well, you know, it's been a long time since I called in, but this whole Ukraine situation is really a big problem. And one of your last callers, quarter after or something like that, he made a lot of good points. But the problem is, in this country, we don't hear any real good information on what's going on over there, and we don't have any history that's presented to us. And, you know, we're going to get ourselves in a shitstorm.
Oh, you can't say that, man.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if we don't get a little history behind us, we're gonna get into a real
mess. Well, here, Jeff, we do have the advantage of the internet now. One thing, there's a flood and flurry of information, and how does one figure out which one to look at? You can go to, there's one that, there's a couple of them. I look at these right-wing news blogs and news sites. I'm going, these people are crazy. Of course, they probably look at the ones I go to and say the same thing. But I look at commondreams.org. That's a great place. Commondreams.org. That's the most accessible one. There is, in fact, these are on my site. If you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, they are there. But so commondreams.org is a good one. Counterpunch.org is another real good one. And Buzzflash, I think that's Buzzflash.com. It's either Buzzflash.com or .org. You got it all there, and particularly Common Dreams.
Well, I get into a lot of trouble because I watch RT, Russia Today.
Yeah, Russia Today, yeah.
And you know, everybody tells me it's propaganda, but I get more honest information from them than I do from any commercial media that we do have in this country.
Well, it's, you can pick and choose. If you have some ideas of your own, like I actually get some information from some right-wing sites, and also I try to listen to them on the radio, some of these right-wing talk show hosts, and look at them to see what are these folks saying, because I get this reflection then in some of the callers. All right, Jeff, thank you very much. Actually, we got kind of a real buzzy connection, so I'm going to cut you a little short. Thank you very much. Well, we were always talking about the USA is never number one anymore, right? But Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates is back on the top of the list of the world's richest people after a four-year fall off. But he's back. A Okay. Forbes magazine announced its ranking of the world's billionaires on Monday. Turns out 11 Michiganders made the list, including Hank and Doug Meyer, co-chairman and grandsons of the founders of the Grand Rapids-based grocer. They earned the highest ranking of billionaires in the Great Lakes states and are worth $8.5 billion. Nothing. Pocket change to Bill Gates and also to Mexican telecom billionaire Carlos Slim Helú, who is second at $72 billion, and Gates with $76 billion. So the two of them together have $148 billion. And so this is, you know, the guy that guy or gal that wrote in from Warren saying that they earn their money. Well, I just don't even know what to say. Their money, what if, they don't have any money, really. I mean, they can get this out and buy whatever they want, and I don't know what this Slim Helú does. But Gates and his wife give away a lot, millions and millions, tens of millions. But like I said, it's a rounding figure. They don't, it's nothing. But Richard DeVos, almost $7 billion. Amway, Dan Gilbert, almost $4 billion. Founder of the Detroit-based home lender Quicken Loans, owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Mike and Marion Illich, $3.5 billion, and it kind of goes down here. Alfred Taubman, Al Taubman, almost $3 billion, shopping centers. Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge, coming in at $1.5 billion. William Clay Ford, Senior. Is he the one? Yeah, he just died. He just died, didn't he, yesterday. Roger Penske. Forbes says a record 1,645 billionaires made the list this year with an average net worth of $4.7 billion. Well, get that. The average net worth is $4.7 billion, and Gates has $76 billion. Think about what that does to the averaging. Total net worth of this year's list is $6.5 trillion. The magazine, think about this. $6.5 trillion, that's... I can't do the math for sure. On 1,645 people have $6.4 trillion. And the Chamber of Commerce and these right-wingers and these restaurant associations are trying to stop people from making $10.10 an hour. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, this is pathological accumulation of wealth. And I know some of you say, it's their money. Again, I don't even get it. It's not money. You have money. No matter, everybody in this listening audience has some money. Maybe even if you're homeless and on the street, you probably have like $1.15 in your pocket, right? Most of us, though, probably live in a home or an apartment, and we have a varying amount of money available to us through whatever, through work or your older Social Security, if you're younger, through your parents, whatever. But it's liquid, right? You have it. Or you might have a bank account. I mean, it could be stashed away in these like retirement things and 401ks, which gets into this deal with what I'm going to talk about with these guys. But as I always say, they say, okay, there's 1,645 of you. You don't even need a real big room. You can get those amount of people in a huge dining hall at Cobo Center, right? And you'd say, you got to come, but you got to bring your $6.4 trillion with you. By the way, this was up from $5.4 trillion last year. So they've made more and more money. They've got richer and richer. And did they work harder? I don't think so. Well, how come they got richer, extraordinarily richer, where so many other people got poorer or just stayed the same or at risk? Right? This is systemic. It's in the nature of the system. So they don't have this money. The money doesn't exist as something they could all plop down. You know, they don't have it. I mean, there's not that much cash around. Or if there is, it's not in something they could bring. So it's just sort of done on faith, the whole way that currency is. You know this stuff called Bitcoin? It's this virtual money. And it just kind of went boom the other day. Some $400 million in Bitcoins disappeared. I don't know. Maybe someone just hit a wrong keystroke or something like that. But it's all kind of crazy, money and net worth. But we know when it comes down to the levels of the average person that it is real. Like, for instance, I'm sure there are people that whose patriotic hearts just beat a little stronger because now Bill Gates is the richest man in the world. He's an American, not a Mexican like Senor Slim Elu, right? So it's good. Number one, number one, number one. But why do we have a system in which that amount of money, which in many ways, I know some of you, the 17% of you millennials that adhere to the Republican Party are going to find not like this, but at social wealth, it's created in a manner by all of us. And it's not like Bill Gates is going off to work every day. It's just all invested. It just all comes back. Well, it's his. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not even sure what that is. What you have is yours, right? Your house, your money, your $1,000, your $100. You know, maybe you've got a 401k with $20,000 or $200,000. That's yours. And you know what you're going to do with it. But how did some guy wind up with $76 billion? More than some countries, right? The budget of some countries, probably the budget of some country. And why are so many people suffering as individuals? So we have close to half the people in this country are poor or near poor and have to struggle all the time. And that's why I've said to this guy that was talking earlier, who objected to me saying that life should be easy. The reason that life is so hard economically for so many people is because Bill Gates has $76 billion along with his other pals that comes out the door at this figure. Where did it go to here? That some trillion dollars. How did that get lost in here? Anyway, that has just gone away. Did I make it up? No. Oh, yeah, here it is. $6.4 trillion. Where is this from? This is from the Detroit News. And 1,645 billionaires with a net worth of $6.4 trillion. If you took $6 trillion away from these guys, confiscated it, right? You said that the marginal tax rate is going to go back to what it was in the 1950s, about 90%. Once you got over a certain figure, the government was taking 90% of it. These millionaires are billionaires now are screaming because I don't know what the upper marginal tax rate is, like 35% or something like that. And this one guy said, we're like the Jews of Germany. You know, they're confiscating our wealth. This is pathological because if you took away $6 trillion from these guys, $6 trillion, a sum that we can't even really visualize, but I'll tell you what it could do in just about a minute, and left them with $4 billion and split it up between 1,645 people, they would be the richest people you knew. They'd be worth tens of millions of dollars. Not billions, not 76 billion, not 10 billion or 9 billion or anything like that. They'd be worth tens of millions of dollars. Or if my math is faulty, which it often is, they'd only be worth millions. They would still have their homes in Grosse Pointe and West Bloomfield, and they would still buy politicians, and they would still do everything they do to be rich guys. Except they wouldn't have this money stalled as it was. Doing nothing for the economy and hurting so many other people. The accumulation of wealth in the manner that it is hurts a lot of people. I hope people have a high opinion of Oxfam. Oxfam is the group that does so much to help people around the world. It's an international aid group, Oxfam International. What they did a study. They said the profits of the world's 100 most wealthy individuals. Now wait a minute, I did not say 1,645, was it? Yeah, 600. I said 100 guys. Man, might be a woman in there too, but it's probably all guys. 100 of the world's 100 the profits of the world's 100 most wealthy individuals could be enough to wipe out world poverty. Ready for that? 100 billionaires could eliminate extreme poverty four times over. That's just 100 of them. In this country, there is 1,645. So when you look and see these scenes of people scrambling, of fighting one another like they are in Ukraine, like they are in Venezuela, like they are throughout Africa, like they are in Asia, that's because people are scrambling or almost driven crazy by the insecurity of life, particularly the insecurity of life. And that's what I say to this guy, Kim, who said, who by implication says that life shouldn't be easy. The reason it's not easy is because you've got these hogs in the middle of the stream. So the majority of people in this world cannot get clean, cool water. That's a metaphor. What do you think about that? 248-544-WRIF. Coming up at 1 a.m., by the way. Got some interesting interviews to tell you about that in a minute. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Peter.
Hey, Fred.
Well, I called to debate you just a little bit about certain people's money.
Okay.
Now, I just want to start off by saying I wouldn't trade one Bill Gates or one Warren Buffett for all of the Vosses, for all the Koch brothers, for all the Donald Trumps in the world.
In other words, they have some heart.
Yes.
Okay.
And it takes a little work to give away a lot of money.
Yeah, that's what I said. They couldn't give it all. They couldn't give it all away if they tried.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you have the real greed heads who try to suck it all up, blame the poor and powerless out here, as if they themselves were beyond reproach. And like you said, they actually earned it, which you didn't earn. $1 billion. So,
well, I always think if this country had any sense to it, once you got over $5 million, you'd have a 90% tax on income. And people always say you wouldn't have any initiative. Like, and my response, if you've been listening a long time, knows all right. I wouldn't get out of bed for $5 million, man. They would just sap my initiative. And you did that, and you cut the war budget in half, got rid of, Obama now is expanding the nuclear U.S. force and all this stuff. You would have the ability to stop the kind of want and the kind of economic insecurity and everything that comes with it. Crime? People always say, why is there crime? Well, you know who commits most of the big crimes, of course, are committed by the rich, but the crimes that we are most afraid of, poor people. Who else sticks up somebody? Who else breaks into a house? People, middle-class people with good jobs? It's the poor.
No.
And the more poor, what we're lucky is that more people don't do that.
But, that's getting to my point.
Okay.
I think what makes life hard out here are the people down here on the ground, like the Kims in the world. There's a lot more of them than rich. And they carry all of these ignorant, bigoted ideas around with them. And you encounter a lot more of them on a day-to-day basis.
You know what? I think they're in the minority. They just, the loudest. And they, mean, angry, intolerant people whose life is not based on a loving acceptance of everyone, they stand out. Anger is the thing that sticks in our mind. You could be somewhere and 20 people would say, hi, Fred, how you doing? One guy yell at you, and 2 days later you'd be thinking about that, right?
Exactly.
And these guys are always yelling. And they're always threatening. They're always, talking about guns. These politicians, who's that old fool from, where is it? Which of those Republicans was holding up a gun in Congress?
Oh, the idiot from Kentucky.
No, McConnell. McConnell.
Mitch McConnell, right.
Mitch McConnell. I mean, what? I don't know. I don't know what to say. All right, Fred, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Appreciate it. Speaking about crime, I was born, I always say, you know, people say you're born and raised in Detroit. So I was born and raised hell in Detroit. For a while lived in Highland Park, which was, at the time I was there, was really high crime. And, I don't know whether I've said this before. I think I did. I used to sleep with a 12-gauge shotgun under my bed. I was that worried. And when I went off to work here at WRI, we did something called the Riff Rock Cafe all night, where we played great rock and roll music, and my wife slept with an M1 carbine under the bed. What is one of the, you know, say, oh, it's a little World War II relic. But, you know, they'll do the job. And so I figured out at some point that's not any way to live. But a lot of people don't have those options to move out of there, and they're stuck there. But here's what's going on. Another would-be burglar was shot Thursday by a Detroit homeowner. That's the fifth of such incident in recent weeks. And it happened yesterday, the day before. Two men broke into a home on the city's west side. And according to Detroit Police 3rd Deputy Chief Rodney Johnson, the homeowner was able to retrieve his weapon and fired, hitting one of the burglars. He ran away and collapsed in the driveway. The other burglar was able to escape. Now, the legal justification is that once somebody has broken into your house in that manner, that you are in a threatened situation. Once someone is in there and has already committed felonious entry, the idea that that along with this would come great bodily harm, death, rape, something like that, allows the use of deadly force. And as you could tell by my comments just a minute ago, I was perfectly prepared to do the same, to defend myself, my house, and my wife, and I guess she was ready to defend me. Let's see. The Detroit Police 3rd Deputy Chief Johnson said, "It's a message to the criminals. Stop coming into people's homes unannounced and uninvited." That's good advice. And other incidents include a woman in her 50s on Friday shot a man and killed a man trying to break into her home on Grove Street. I don't know where that is. February 22nd, two home invaders were killed. 2 a.m., two men broke into a house on the city's southwest side. The homeowner shot both men to death. A 21-year-old man died and another man escaped. Not sure if that's part of the same story. Earlier, a woman who was surprised by a gunman when she pulled her car into the garage was able to reach for her own gun and fatally shot the man. In an incident that made national headlines, a woman on February 17th opened fire on three teens who kicked in her door. The alleged intruders, 14, 14, and 15, were caught by police and face home invasion charges. I mean, I'm surprised this all isn't in, or maybe, I bet you it all is, in the NRA's publication, The Rifleman. Detroit Police Chief James Craig caused a national stir in January when he told the Detroit News he felt the city's crime rate would go down if more people were armed because it would make criminals think twice about breaking into their homes or attacking them. Well, two things occur to me. I mean, that even could be correct, and I hate to say it. I mean, I look back on that, and the idea that I would have been taking someone's life or severely injured them with a gun is kind of creeps me out in a way, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And if I lived in Detroit, and if I lived in a home among the poor, and I probably would be similarly armed, without a doubt, because as these people found out, they used to say, it was saying in Detroit, better that the police find you with a gun than the criminals find you without one. I mean, it's sort of, you know, street talk. But that doesn't alter the statistics that on one hand that these people were able very possibly to save themselves from grievous harm or at least being put in an extraordinarily threatening situation. You don't want to find out the results of it. The two points. One is that does not mean that you are still at high risk to be hurt yourself, by accident, shoot somebody else in anger, commit suicide with it. Those statistics don't go away just because the utility of a self-defense weapon actually gets used for what it's supposed to be used for, right? Also, people frequently have break-ins and their guns are stolen and then wind up in the hands of other people. I don't know whether actually this will send the crime rate down or not. People are desperate. People are poor. And that's what the real nub of it all. Why do we live in a society? I was thinking that as I locked my door. I live in a suburb of Detroit. I locked my door, and when I left, my wife put on the alarm system. My wife put on the alarm system. One does not leave your door open. I suppose there's a lot of areas, and I'm sure some of you are living in areas, maybe even suburbs, where you can leave your door open. I live pretty close to Detroit, so I don't leave my door unlocked at any time. And when we go to sleep, and no gun under the bed anymore, but there's an alarm on. And why do we live in a world like this? We live in a world, we're told, because there are criminals, because there's bad people, because there's people that are predators, all of which is true, by the way. But then we think, when it's a mass phenomenon, I mean, even in the best of worlds, even in a society with everybody connected in a real way, there's probably still going to be people that are going to be transgressors, and a society has to deal with this. But it gets ramped up considerably depending upon how desperate people are, how poor people are, how much they begin to lose their connection to other people and see people as someone to take advantage of. I mean, I was thinking about that and all of the internet messages you get. I mean, I don't know about you, but I get 20 messages a day, people trying to take advantage of me. And whoa, hello, welcome to the real world. Why is the real world set up like this? Isn't it in part because you have 100 guys that have enough money, have enough wealth that they could end poverty? Isn't it because in the United States that you have 1,645 billionaires that have a net worth of over $6 trillion that people say, I got an idea. We don't have any money. Let's go break into the house down the street. I don't think that. Yeah, I mean, because I don't have to. Because I have a wage. Because I have a job. Because I have a home. You start losing that, things start to fray. And so the poorer the area, people are always saying, well, let's do a sociological study as to why people commit crimes. And, I mean, I'm sure most poor people don't commit crimes. We've talked about this before. Say it's 5%. That's a crime wave. If you got 5% of the people in your neighborhood, you know, trying to steal your stuff or stick you up or something like that. And again, I would say if I lived in Detroit or an area like that, I would be, who knows? I mean, I don't know if I would be carrying a gun. And that's what I understand, that people aren't anywhere near this field that they got to carry a gun because, you know, you never can tell what's going to happen. Well, you got to, they're the ones that are really at high risk for self-harm or accidentally shooting somebody or shooting somebody in a rage or having their gun stolen and winding up in the hands of some crooks who are going to use it to break into somebody's house in Detroit. Anyway, I think that's called rambling, but maybe you get it. There's a new RIP bullet. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be scrambling to get that one. It's called a radically invasive projectile. I'll tell you about that and some other stuff when we get back. You want to call in the meantime, 248-544-WRIF.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, Here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, this is our final segment. Not ours, it's my. Jolene's off. Her birthday was Sunday. So I said, Jolene, go out with your boyfriend. Have a good time. She said, okay, bye. 248-544-WRIF. At noon today, there'll be a podcast up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. A lot of good stuff there anyways. We like to be liked, so you can go to that. My website is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And at 1 a.m., I'm going to be playing an interview with somebody who wrote a book called Rules Are to Be Broken, A Child's Guide to Anarchy. You go, wait a minute. Kids are too anarchistic. Not that they're not enough, but it's an interesting interview. And then one on marriage, because right now we're here in Detroit. Friday was the last day of testimony before is it Judge Friedman that is going to make a decision on whether the Michigan Constitution violates the U.S. Constitution in terms of equal protection under the law for the right for marriage equality. The other thing we were talking about earlier, and I think I deleted that, Kim from Warren wrote in and was letting me have it, telling me I was a slacker, which I didn't deny particularly. Actually, I did. I'm not a slacker, really. And telling me that I was typical mindset because I said life should be easy. Talking about my life, I graduated high school at 20, was a slacker in high school, never finished college. And he said that, admitted I was lazy, and he said other lazy liberals take advantage of their parents. And that I complain about the wealthy. So I said, I didn't know. I wonder if this was a millennial, 18 to 33, we were talking about them. And I didn't know also whether Kim, because it's a, what do you call it? A unisexual name. You can either be man or a woman. Kim writes back, it's Kim from Warren. I'm a woman. I'm 54 years old, and I'm an independent. I'm not a right-wing conservative. Thought you were. Okay. But here's proof she wasn't, I think. The reason I say that about liberals is because I'm surrounded by them. They're all on welfare, and it's what I see daily, so I'm sorry that's what I'm surrounded by. Everybody in Warren is on welfare? And, you know, the poor and the working class tend to be Democratic. And if people, for one thing, I don't even know what welfare means, Kim. I mean, why don't you call me? You know, that'd be a little easier. Because there's no more welfare. It's not like able-bodied men are on welfare. There's aid to dependent children, stuff like that. Is that, I don't even know if that's still what they call it. I mean, there's people whose income qualifies them for food stamps. And if they're getting that, it means they're not getting, most of the people getting food stamps are employed. It means that wages suck so badly. But here, this is what gets me, and I don't understand, Kim. She says, I don't feel that way about all liberals. She said, I worked for GM and Chrysler for 15 years and belonged to the UAW my whole life. My father worked downtown at the Solidarity House, at Solidarity House, which is the UAW International Headquarters. So did I. While I grew up, we're at a very Democratic, convention from 64 to 76. We were at every Democratic Party convention from 1964 to 1976. Just a little background. You did say, Peter, that life should be easy. I do. Of course it should. Why does it have to be hard? Why is the ultra rich living so good that they've got so much money that they don't even know what the hell to do with it? And the average person, particularly as you start to hit the lower middle class, going to the working class, that life is so damn hard. when you have a 1,645 billionaires in the United States that make $6 trillion plus. And here, this article in the New York Times. You guessed it. The rich are getting richer, and shocker, they're having a pretty good time spending their money. The ultra-rich shattered many records last year, buying notable works of art, shiny baubles, and sleek toys. Someone just bought a 1967 Ferrari Spider. This is a car. $27.5 million. Francis Bacon's, this is a painter, three studies of Lucian Freud sold for, this is a painting. There's three of them. It's called a triptych. Three of them, and $142 million. And 12 bottles of 1978 Domaine de la Romanée Conti, described as one expert, as close to perfect as wine gets, landed in someone's collection. This is 12 bottles of wine, a case, $500,000. Okay. Eat the rich, because they're eating us. She says, when I say the wealthy earn their money, what I mean is they more than likely went to college and worked their butts off. They didn't party and play pool like you. I'm glad I did. I'm not envious of the wealthy. The only thing, when I worked for the UAW on their broadcasting network, and I broadcast from Solidarity House, I started thinking, man, I could wind up a millionaire. And I started thinking about who I was going to give it to. I had an idea in my mind of what would be good for me and my wife, what would justify life, expenditures in terms of what is ethical. And my ethics. And I was thinking probably 100,000. Something like that. After that, I was going to give it all away. I would have been the most popular guy among liberal and environmental groups, that's for sure. Never came to that, though. Anyway, they didn't party and play pool like you, and totally disrespected their parents paying for it. Well, is it disrespecting my parents? I was 21, 22 years old. I was into partying. Didn't you party, Kim? Is she calling me? Let me see. Let me get back to the calls anyway. Now, here's Jim in Detroit. Jim, hey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Doing good. What's up?
Good. I just got a couple questions for you.
Sure.
Okay, you said something about those kids getting murdered. They would get shot at breaking into houses, and they were in their teens. Why aren't these kids in school? Why did they have single mothers? How was that set up? Shouldn't they be in high school or something?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know what happens in poor communities. Kids don't. Well, I didn't finish high school until I got kicked out of school. That's why I didn't finish.
Okay, yeah, but your parents made you go back, and you had two parents probably at home.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, that is a definition, though, of the middle class. When you start to, and increasingly, that's not even, as the poverty rates grow in this country, also, the families begin to split apart. And so you have, I forgot what it is, like half of the kids in America now are living with single parents or some high figure. So those are
society's fault, though, is it really?
Well,
that's an individual's choices. I mean, if you're going to have sex, take a precaution.
Well, if once things have a mass expression, it's kind of a weird deal. I mean, what you and I do as individuals is our choice. I mean, most kids do not break into houses, without a doubt. So it's a small percentage, but enough, you know, to create a problem. But when you start having half the people living in single parents and all that, that's a social expression. That has to do with the way the country's constructed. That has to do, it's not what causes poverty. It's what poverty causes. It happens like that all over the world.
No, that's not true. 95% of people that have a baby before they're 20 years old end up in poverty.
But
95%.
Well, I'm sure. But you know what? Not the middle class kids and not the rich kids that do that. It's poor kids. But again, these are definitions of poverty, but it's not what causes poverty. It's what poverty causes. I mean, it's about distribution of income. We have the lowest minimum wage of any major industrialized country. We have the highest number of poor people. We have the worst prison conditions. We have the worst roads. We have the worst everything. And at the same time, we got guys buying cars for $25 million.
Google Bill Gates and his charitable, him and Warren Buffett are two of the most charitable people.
They are. They give away lots of money, but they can't. We were saying earlier, they give away their pocket change. Buffett. I'm sure if you told Bill Gates and Warren Buffett that we were going to start in having a tax system like we used to have under Eisenhower, where it was a 90% rate over, I forgot what it was, $6 million or something like that. I don't even know if they would object. They know their money is just not doing anything for anybody. It's not doing anything for them, and they don't need. They could still give away hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm sorry to cut you short, but we've got Kim on the line, so let me go get her. Hi, Kim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
What's going on?
You tell me. You're talking to a slacker. You know what? Let me tell you. I'm going to let you talk, but let me tell you why I made that distinction. I was saying that, in fact, it wasn't all of it. I said I was lazy, had no initiative, I was a slacker, a goof-off, I drank in college, played pool, and all that, and I'm just doing okay. I mean, doing well, actually. And I said that was that had to do with class, race, and gender. If you didn't have those things, you were at a great disadvantage, and you could, if you didn't have those things working for you, you'd wind up in bad shape.
So I was just basically repeating your words back to you.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know. But go ahead.
I don't know. Maybe you just kind of got offended.
No, I wasn't offended. I loved it.
Oh, did you?
Well, I don't mind being called. I mean, listen, you know, there was the Marxist movement used to say, workers of the world unite. That was their revolutionary call. I always have said, workers of the world relax. I mean, why should we have to work our butts off just to survive in a world where life could be a lot easier as long as people didn't have to suffer such economic insecurity, get paid such bum wages, get not benefits, not have health care?
You know, the few people that I know that, you know, have a lot of money, like, you know, close to $1 million,
yeah,
do work their butts off, you know. I know dentists and doctors and stuff like that, and they work their butts off. They work a ton of hours, and they work all the time, and that's why they have so much money. And well, I'm just thinking that's what you have to do if you want to be rich.
Yeah, well, first off, doctors and dentists, I mean, some doctors make hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, essentially ripping off the medical system, but a lot of them don't. I mean, I assume that the doctors and dentists I go to probably make around $150,000 a year, which puts them up, in the 10th percentile or the 90th percentile, right? But that's not rich. That's middle class. They live in Pleasant Ridge.
My girlfriend's brother is a dentist, and the house he lives in is close to $1 million house. So he's making a very good living.
Well, maybe more than that. But even if he's making $250,000, that still doesn't put him, he's not rich. That's still like upper middle class. But are you saying, is your opinion, Kim, that if everybody worked hard, everybody could be a millionaire?
No. But if you work hard, you can make a nice wage. You're not a millionaire, but you can make a nice wage and have a nice living.
I mean, so all those poor people and the people you say you're surrounded by that are on welfare, if every one of them worked hard, every one of them could have a decent living, decent wage?
Not in this society.
No, well, that's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about, because there's not enough jobs. There's four people looking for every one job there is. And a lot of the jobs, and if people got educated, if everybody, you know, I always say this, everybody got educated, if everybody tried as hard as they could, somebody would have to fill those jobs that were making, that were paying $7.25 an hour with no benefits.
Yeah, if they would have started out right out of high school and went to college and, you know, taken it from there, maybe they would be, you know, making a nice wage now and,
But everybody can't do that. The slots aren't there. I mean,
I'm aware of that.
I know.
I'm aware of that. My dad tried to talk me into going to college, and I wanted nothing to do with it because I just didn't like school.
So how are you doing? Are you doing? You're not on welfare.
No. Lucky, like I told you, he worked at Solidarity House, and he was able to get me a job at Chrysler, and then I got laid off from there, and he got me a job at General Motors, and then I took a buyout from there.
Okay. Well, but, you know, but what you're saying, you know, I'm sure if you worked at those automobile plants, you were working hard. I mean, I always say, someone says, why'd you get into radio? I always joke and say, well, I tried honest work, and it was too hard. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of what they call self-deprecating humor. You know, some people say, "God, the guy's on there for, you know, like an entertainer. He just comes out and sings for 40 minutes and he makes $50,000. That's the nature of the entertainment industry. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Well, so you landed on your feet because of connections.
Exactly, because of my dad.
Yeah, well, so... why are you any different than me? Okay. You worked hard, at least, in effect. Kim, you have a good night, okay?
You too, Peter.
All right. Well, that was nice. Okay, here is Todd in Madison Heights. Todd, hi, you're on the air. Todd, are you with me?
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm right here.
Good, go ahead, you're on the air.
With that last caller, though, I mean... with the jobs that are around, how can a young kid even afford anything unless they were one of those entitled kids right now that are given everything?
Well, there's some thought that people are actually better off if they don't go to college rather than coming out with $60,000 in debt. How long does it take you to pay that back? You know, that's nuts. I mean, you get started early in something else or I don't know. And it used to be that the middle class, mostly the people that went to college, were middle class people from middle class families, and colleges were relatively inexpensive. And then they were in middle class professions that paid pretty well. Now, even a lot of the middle class, old middle class professions don't pay real well. And to visit it, here's what I was trying to say to Kim. To visit it as an individual doesn't understand that why it's this mass phenomena. I mean, you have half the country. I mean, it's up like about 44% of the people are either poor or near poor, struggling all the time, concerned about paying the bills. That creates enormous stress in people's lives. That's, you have stress in a marriage. You have, you know, arguing about kids, whether you can get them this and that and what they need and what they want and all that. And then, you know, it's not what causes poverty. It's what poverty causes. And people see it as all this individual initiative. If you tried real hard, well, any individual, a particular individual, they can be the poorest person in the country and they could wind up rich. But that's unusual. The majority of poor people stay poor. The majority of working class people stay working class. Middle class, same thing. Upper class, same thing. 1% just give their money to their kids. Yeah.
Yeah. It's scary. And this is the times that we're living in right now.
Absolutely.
And nobody will give in to help anybody else but themselves.
Well, I got to tell you, it's time. From the beginning of this country, literally from the origin, where the founding fathers, let's have some music in the background, took it upon themselves, they said that they're going to alter history. And every movement, from the abolition of slavery and the women's vote movement and the labor movement, the anti-war movements, civil rights movements, all this, people said they're not going to take it. They're not going to do it anymore. And there are, for instance, so many of you college students that are listening that owe great amounts of money. There's all sorts of organizations and even movements across this country that are saying college should be free. We shouldn't be putting that burden on our young people, that we shouldn't have to put added stress to a young student's life. I'm thinking every time they're in a class, there's like a cash register chinging. But it's got to be a mass movement, and it's not there right now. So everybody just thinks, oh, we're screwed. And I'm not blaming you, and I'm not blaming any individual person because, you know, one day there's nothing, the next day Rosa Parks gets on a bus, and boom, the whole thing explodes. And the way things are put together now, there's enough people angry, probably that's going to happen. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let me get a quick one in here to Bill and Wayne. Bill, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Bill, you with me?
I'm doing very good.
Yeah, go ahead.
it's, you know, what causes poverty are the illegal immigrants that are coming in from Mexico.
Well, Bill, you just, it's absolutely nuts. I don't even got time to talk to stupid. Go read something. Hey, this is George in where? Bingster?
Inkster. Oh,
my Jefferson put up Bingster. Go ahead from Inkster. Yeah, it sounds good. Wonder where the
basically,
hell.
Basically, truthfully, I honestly believe that the only way you're going to get anywhere right now in society is if your birth certificate states you weren't born in the United States.
Well, you know what? That though is as dumb as the last guy. Come on. People are coming in because they're taking the, in fact, people are going back to Mexico because there's not enough jobs here. You know, I expect more from you folks than that. I mean, don't, you know, the immigrants are coming in and taking our jobs. That's not it. Who took your jobs are the wealthy industrialists who wanted to pay people in Mexico and Indonesia and China, $2 an hour rather than paying good union middle class wages. Don't blame it on this poor ambition. We talk about ambitious. This ambitious guy with initiative since NAFTA not only ruined the economy here, but also ruined the economy of Mexico. They want to go to make some money and send it back to their folks. Well, those jobs aren't even there for them. Immigrants come in, if we're talking about Latin American immigrants, and there's others, are coming in and taking jobs at dirt cheap wages, and they're not taking the kind of jobs that made Detroit, the Motor City, the arsenal of democracy during World War II, and all of that. So if you're looking for scapegoats, it ain't the immigrants. It's the people that run this society that create a distribution of wealth that gives them trillions and gives you $7.25 an hour. All right, got a couple of really good interviews coming up. One, it's called A Child's Guide to Anarchy. Whew. And another one about marriage. And that's, we never even got to what's happening here in Detroit with that trial. But maybe we'll talk about that next week. Well, Jolene was off. It was her birthday on Sunday. We wish her a big happy birthday. And she and I will be back next week live. Stay tuned for the interviews.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call.
Now through March 17th, switch to Verizon and buy one Samsung Galaxy S4 for $99.99 and get one free. You'll also get a $100 bill credit for each new smartphone line you activate. Click the banner to buy now. Activation, early termination, and other fees may apply. Bill credit applied within 2 to 3 billing cycles.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas like entertainment or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
This makes me so excited.
Everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I've heard the expression that everyone is born an anarchist and everything else is learned. In other words, we're what's called socialized. We learn how to interact with people, not to be selfish, not to hurt other people. In other words, we have, and this is the common thought, we live in a world based on rules. And the more strict the rules are enforced, goes the thinking, the more peaceful a society will be. And when we have people acting out, not following the rules, well, everything goes to hell, right? That is the common perception. And we have to begin, we're told, with children that are very young. Toilet training, you don't want to poop them all over the house and what have you. And you know, you can't take that away from your little brother and all of the rest of it, right? Well, how about anarchy for kids? What would you think about that? Well, you say, well, they're already anarchists. I'm trying to calm these kids down. A book has come my way in the most unusual way. We'll get into that in a minute. It's actually a children's book. It's called A Rule is to Break. A Rule is to Break. Now, that goes against what we were just saying. It's a child's guide to anarchy, and it's by John and Jana. And they are a husband and wife team. They go under that name, and they write. They've written children's books before. They have twin boys of their own, and I'm real anxious to talk to them. We're reaching them at their home in North Adams, Massachusetts. And John and Jana, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter.
Hi, thank you.
I bet while I was giving that introduction, you were probably formulating about 19 answers, right? I mean, this does confound everyone's sense of socialization, that kids, they need rules. A rule is not to break. It's the opposite. Tell me your perspective on it before we get, oh, we should say, by the way, the book is pretty much a picture book. And it's for kids, right? I mean, adults can read it, but
and grown-ups, yeah.
Yeah, and grown-ups, and but it's got marvelous drawings, and mostly. So then I was going to ask you, answered my question, Jana. You're the illustrator, right?
I'm the illustrator. Yep.
Yeah, that was the hard part because when you read, I'm sorry, John, but when you read the text, it's fairly limited, but. Thoughtful and creative, I should say. All right, now I've covered my butt. Tell me, how is a rule to break? It's the opposite. We're supposed to follow the rules.
You want to take this, John?
Go ahead. Come on, guys. You got to bam, bam, bam. Go ahead. John.
Ask me that again, okay? I'm thinking.
The rules are made to be followed. We have to create rules for kids. We wind up with Lord of the Flies. That's the argument. Maybe we could have anarchism for adults where people interact democratically and make decisions by consensus and what have you, run our neighborhoods, our factories.
Right.
But anarchist kids? Wow.
Yeah, well, I guess you're kind of teaching kids cooperation in that setting. So maybe a rule, you know, no rules might be taking it to a whimsical extreme. Maybe rules might come out of it. But they'd be rules that collectively, would come out of a dialogue between adults and children and children and other children.
I think the book is less there are no rules and more a rule is to be questioned. For example, one of the pages is... when someone says work, you say why. the answer is not, the response from the child is not no, but the response is why. In other words, you know, explain to me why this is important and let me make my own decision.
So it's not rebellion. You know what I mean? I mean, so my dad would say to me, mow the lawn, and I didn't ask him why, or because he would not have gone for the questioning. But if I would have said why, what you're saying, then he would have said, look at it. We want to have a nice house presented in our neighborhood, so we have a nice neighborhood, and it's too long. I mean, that's,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, our message really is not to, you know, not blindly do the opposite of any rule, but rather... before kids are sort of indoctrinated to follow blindly and then through adulthood, follow blindly everything that you're told, to question it, think about it. And it really is aimed at kids. The age group we're looking at is, you know, when kids start public school and they are told to do any number of things that might not make any sort of logical sense. And it's okay. It's okay for kids to question that, you know.
Well,
we had, you know, our kids would come home from school. They're now, we unschool our kids. They're home with us all day, and we have a very child-led learning experience here at home. And, you know, through the years they were in public school, you know, they were told all kinds of things that we didn't necessarily agree with, that they didn't necessarily agree with. And instead of saying, well, you have to do that because your teacher told you to, we would talk about it and say, oh, well, why do you think your teacher told you to do that? And, you know, maybe with this one, you know, problem we're having, let's talk to the teacher and see if maybe we can find another way around this. You know, instead of, you know, sitting in circle time, our kids you know, might feel like they needed to stand up, you know, or, you know, we're not talking about, you know, complete and total rebellion, but, you know, can we talk to the teacher and say, you know, is it okay if you, you know, stand on the other side of the room or, you know, I don't know, whatever. But there were, you know, lots of examples of that.
Well, the book.
I would say that children do have a lot of arbitrary rules tossed at them, you know, to make it convenient for the adult in the room. So a lot of the times it's the question why, the answer is because I said so. And I think because I said so really translates into because this makes it easier on me. And, you know, I think there are other ways to go about it, especially to you're just teaching a kid to be the same by saying that. And I don't know if that's helpful.
Well, you, one of the first pages in your book, A Rule is to Break a Child's Guide to Anarchy, says, don't look like everyone else. Be you. And then there's drawings by Jenna and that text by John. Actually, our guests are John Seven and Jenna Christie, and they write under John and Jenna. You can go to johnandjenna.com. It's published by Manic D Press. You can go to manicdpress.com. And there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Now, since you've had experience raising children, I will relate this incident to you real quickly. I was on a bicycle trip in Europe a few years ago, and the guy I was riding with and I, we stayed at the home of two people who were self-identified anarchists, and they had a child to which they said they were going to do no supervision. So the kid would come in and turn the television up full blast, would start breaking stuff. He started to like smash something of mine. And I said, whoa, hey, kid, you know. And he just looked at me with rage. We went to a pub and he demanded beer. So this kid needed some rules. I don't have any children, so I wouldn't, you know, I knew this wasn't the way to go.
Right,
but tell us a little about your experience in raising your children. Are they out of control? How old are they now, by the way?
They're 17.
Okay, so are they out of control, law-breaking, rule-breaking?
They're very in control. I think they need to temper their parents a lot of times.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, I think... No, our kids are amazingly polite and sweet guys, very, very thoughtful and very, very intelligent, and actually very conscious of societal rules, which we, you know, taught them as they were growing up. They needed to be courteous to people, and that's in the book. You know, listen to the tiniest voice is one of the pages, and that's kind of what we're getting at. You know, it's... They were always taught to be aware of their place in society. In other words, you know, be aware that there are people around you, and you need to be conscious of that. So you're not allowed to just, you know, run rampant through stores and, you know, be a crazy person. You have to be conscious of others, but at the same time, you know, you're allowed to express yourself, and you're allowed to question what people tell you. And you can, and you respond, but you respond in a way that, you know, isn't hurtful to other people. What we're trying to do essentially is what our goal was with raising our own children, and what went into the book was we want to raise amazing citizens, you know, people who want to go out and help in the world and, you know, want to give back and are really able to listen to other people. And I think the only way you can really raise a good citizen is to have them question what they're told.
That poster or in bumper sticker, question authority.
Authority, exactly.
Authority doesn't like that at all.
It's troublesome.
You know, you mentioned supermarkets. I was actually banned from supermarket. My mother was, because I would, you know, like tear. This is like when I was 3 years old. I would tear cans off the shelves and pull down displays. I mean, I had a horrible time in school. I graduated high school when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
I just had the worst time. And I guess my advice usually to, and these were very rigid authoritarian, well, not the supermarket, but the schools, where it, and you had no choice but to follow the rule. I would have said why to any teacher.
It
would have been a problem. And usually when I tell young people that are having problems, I said, look, the younger you are, the more vulnerable you are to authority and the less space you have to be rebellious or challenge the authority. And there's very little you can do to be quite blunt about it. I mean, sorry to say that. It's not true. I wouldn't say that like in society at large. But within a controlled authoritarian system like a school, a kid that is going to be, read your book, A Rule is to Break, A Child's Guide to Anarchy, that could encourage them to have the same problems I had. You think?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, okay. I think if it encourages a kid to have those problems, then it's as if you're tossing a bomb into their room and not, you know, paying attention to what you've done. You know, ideally, I think a parent and a kid would read the book together, talk about it. What do you think? Discuss that sort of thing. Rather than, you know, just hand it to the kid and say, this is a model for your behavior, do this, you know.
You know, looking through your book, it is, somewhere or other, I think it said it was gentle. I mean, because it's not saying that. It's not saying, like, I'm trying to think of those movies. There was one in the 30s, Zero for Conduct, and then there was a remake of it where the kids at the end are on top of the school roof with a machine gun. So that's not what it's all about. I mean,
it's not how to build a pipe bomb.
Right, because in A Rule is to Break, here I'm looking at one page, invent a new holiday. I mean, so that's, in many ways, it's about trying to be kind of a joyous person. Would you say that's a good description?
Yeah, and be original and unto yourself. It's like, I think holidays, that's one of the things we put in, because that gets a lot of people touchy. You know, not celebrating certain holidays right, all that. And it's just the sort of thing that we thought, well, you know, kids should just be able to celebrate what a kid finds important, and it shouldn't be if anything, holidays shouldn't be an authoritarian nightmare, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Well, I was going to say, here's another page, which on the face of it is pretty gentle, but it has different sort of social implications. One of the reasons that parents like to see kids have, like, Kool-Aid stands is because they're beginning to learn the basis of business. They're selling stuff, and that's what they say our society is based around. You have a page, another delightful page, that says, give stuff away for free. Well, that's kind of anarchistic, to be sure. Hey, go ahead if you want to comment on that. Go ahead.
Did you want to do that, Jan?
Well, we do think people should give away stuff for free. That doesn't mean you have to, you know, give away everything you have for free, and it doesn't mean, you know, you don't, it's wrong to earn a living, but I also don't see the harm in a kid who may have a lemonade stand and who might give away some of their lemonade either. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like a really beautiful thought, and we try and encourage that with our kids, and, you know, we try and practice that too. So, you know, I think giving away stuff for free is just a no-brainer.
Yeah, when we do signings, book signings, what we try to do is, because, you know, I wouldn't expect that the bookstore is going to give books away for free, we try to do, say, a food drive for a local pantry, and then we'll have art prints, and we'll trade people the art print for food pantry donation. So, you know, there's a practical example of giving things away for free while still making a living.
Yeah, so folks are giving away stuff for free. They're donating food, and we're giving stuff away free. We're giving away signed art, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, that's one example.
The book is A Rule is to Break, A Child's Guide to Anarchy. It's published by Manic D Press. You can go to manicdpress.com. The authors signed their work, John and Jana, and you can go to johnandjana.com. That's J-A-N-A and the word and spelled out.
And there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Sometimes people ask me, where do you find all these authors? And a variety of different ways. But you were done the most amazing favor by sort of an unexpected source. There used to be years and years ago when the city of Boston had this real strict code enforcement for censors, essentially, for movies in Boston. And people would say, banned in Boston. And people would go, whoa, that must be pretty sexy or something like that. So, but now taking on the role, the censorious role, is the Tea Party, who has condemned your book on anarchy and said this is a horrible thing, which just blasted it almost the article was in the Guardian of London. So it blasted it into international acclaim. What was this a big surprise to you?
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything about the book that I ever thought closed-minded member of the Tea Party might object to without seeing it, just based on the title, but mm-hmm. that's kind of the point. I don't think the people who actually said the stuff they said had actually read the book, and I think they were also reacting to, we have an endorsement quote from Bill Ayers, and that seemed to really ignite their fury. So
Bill Ayers, I was going to just remind people that Bill Ayers, as they refer to him in The Guardian, is an educationalist, I guess maybe educator. Bill Ayers, and quite a prominent educator now in the state of Illinois, but in his wild youth, he was a member of the Weathermen and had been part of a campaign of bombing. So they plus they say that he palled around with Barack Obama, which isn't true. I've actually palled around with Bill Ayers. I've known him for years, but
don't run for president.
Yeah, no, I won't. I won't. And so here's what they say. The book alone is horrendous enough. But it even gets, and the book, if you're just joining us, is A Rule to Break a Child's Guide to Anarchy. And if it had a different title and you just said, like, good ideas on how to be a kid and not be a little robot when you grow up, that it probably wouldn't even have attracted all of this. But it says, the book alone says the Tea Party is horrendous enough, but it gets even worse when we realize Bill Ayers, radical terrorist leftist and friend of Obama, not only endorses it, through his Twitter account, his comments in support of the book are listed on the actual Amazon book page. Wow. Wow. That's.
I know. Can you believe it?
Yeah. And Bill, I know, now, like I say, is a well-respected educator and speaks as someone with children and who deals with children, has assessed this. Did you have any thoughts about this, or was this all part of, the book title and getting Bill Ayers there? Did you think, whoa, we're going to wind up on the pages of the international press? Did this have any forethought?
We didn't think it would go that far. We thought that when we received the book, I think it was Jana who came up with the actual Child's Guide to Anarchy and the character. And sure, we saw that as a little provocative. I mean, I don't see how you can't. And then I had met Bill, and I thought, he should endorse this book. Mm-hmm. You know, it just seemed right. One, because it was something I felt he'd really just like the book, and two, for exactly the reasons you say. Of course, Bill Ayers endorsing a book with the word anarchy in it for children will get attention. I mean, people will notice that. But, you know, we wouldn't have done that if it didn't reflect his ideals. We wouldn't have asked him.
Right. And when the book title came to me and when I started playing around with the character, it wasn't and I had no forethought of trying to be provocative. It came to me the way other story ideas came to me, and the same way that story ideas come to John. It's like you just kind of get a nugget of an idea. And also, we wanted a book that sort of reflected the way we're raising our kids in a way that we haven't seen in bookstores and on bookshelves before. So mm-hmm. It wasn't really to be provocative. It was really just to, I think we get frustrated sometimes raising the kids the way we do, and then going into a bookstore and seeing Pinkalicious and, you know, books written by Tori Spelling. And just it's like, where's a book that, you know, speaks to my kid? So it was more of that, less trying to be provocative.
And I'd also say that we were conceiving it and creating it actually before Occupy happened. So anarchy and anarchist and all that stuff that sort of crept into the popular press had not at the time. We were amazed when it did, and suddenly people started talking about anarchy and anarchists again, like right in time when we finished it. But that was not planned at all.
Well, so. let's go back. We just have about, about 3 or 4 minutes left, and go back to your book. And people are just joining us because I know people get in and out of their cars. The book is A Rule to Break, A Child's Guide to Anarchy. And it's a children's book that is can be easily enjoyed by grown-ups, by John and Jenna, my guests. And the format is drawings with very few words on a page. They're important, the words. It's driven in many ways by the drawings. And here's one. It says, no baths ever again. So how did, I mean, what happened in your house when that went down?
Well,
we're trying to incite a toddler rebellion of really dirty little boys and girls.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do with that one. We want dirty, naked children running all over, smelling up the place.
We got to have some fun.
Yeah.
Exactly. That would make me really happy. You know, that was actually a rule that was questioned by our kids. Our kids did like to question our rules without us telling them they should question our rules. And we did have to forego baths every once in a while that we – you know, in our sort of parental role, reading, you know, parenting books in the beginning of our journey as parents, you know, it's, oh, you know, you've got to take a bath. It's bath day. And, you know, it may be a day in winter when, you know, they've spent the day cranning and, you know, drinking cocoa and, you know, they aren't a big mess. And they'd say, you know, I don't want to. And we would have to question ourselves, why are we telling them to take a bath just because it's bath day if they're not actually dirty?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think they actually probably did go to bed dirty a couple times, too, after days at the beach and they were too tired. And we'd say, oh, whatever, we'll wash the sheets and, you know, they can take their bath the next day. So, you know, kind of the pick your battle.
Yeah, and also it's, I think they try to regiment kids on schedules from the moment they're outside of their mother's body.
Yeah.
You know, nurses are telling like the exact schedule you're supposed to breastfeed. And it seems like it might be nice to ease up a little bit in a kid's life on the schedules, because I don't know that, well, it's the one time in a person's life where you actually do have the time to miss a few appointments, you know, baths, whatever. So you might as well let a kid enjoy that.
Well,
because
I guess
once he enters the workforce, he's got to bathe all the time, or you know, people don't like that.
Yeah, there's got to be a little slack time between the regimentation of the family and the regimentation of the workplace. That's beginning to narrow considerably. Well, your book is an incredible delight, and Bill Ayers on the back of your books is delightful. A children's book on anarchy seems somehow just right and instinctive. I have a copy of it here, so it's an intuitive sense of fairness, community, and interdependence. And the book is A Rule to Break, A Child's Guide to Anarchy. It's condemned by the Tea Party, so if you're of that, you won't want to read this. My guests have been John and Jana. That's how they sign their books and their work. You can go to their website, johnandjana.com. It's J-A-N-A and spelled out. It's John Seven and Jana Christie. And thank you so much for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Certainly. Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Now through March 17th, switch to Verizon and buy one Samsung Galaxy S4 for $99.99 and get one free. You'll also get a $100 bill credit for each new smartphone line you activate. Click the banner to buy now. Activation, early termination, and other fees may apply. Bill credit applied within 2 to 3 billing cycles.
This is your Car Care Minute.
drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com. This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now is the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com. This is your Car Care Minute. Email, texting, and Twitter are some of today's communication tools. But when it comes to vehicle repair or service, a face-to-face meeting with your automotive technician is still the best method of communication to ensure a satisfactory service. But do your homework before taking your vehicle in for repairs or service. Read your owner's manual. Make a written list of your vehicle's dashboard warning signals or changes in performance and handling. Go through your list with the technician or service consultant. Let them diagnose and recommend a remedy. But do ask questions regarding the costs before work begins. Two-way communication. It's the key to better automotive service. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
101 WRIF, locking in everything that rocks.
61 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know that song, remember that? Love and Marriage? Love and Marriage go together like a horse and carriage. Many of you might know it from the Fox sitcom, Married with Children, you know, when marriage had not become Ozzie and Harriet as it was in the 1950s. And it was played in sort of an ironic manner. And the song itself stems back to the 1950s. In fact, Frank Sinatra sang it. It's a, what was his name? I can't even, Steve Conner, a great songwriter in any event. And it was said then, sang then as well, as a serious affirmation of marriage. One man, one woman, for every boy, for every girl, all of that. And today we see a lot of echo of that same sort of perspective. Marriage is about a man and a woman, and there's fights. Can it be same-sex couples? Can people just live together and be recognized? All of that. But still, that tradition we're told of a man and a woman with the with maybe a church and for certain the state sanctifying this union is what marriage is all about. Or is it? Well, I have a great book here. It's called A History of Marriage, From Same-Sex Unions to Private Vows in Common Law, The Surprising Diversity of a Tradition. The author is Elizabeth Abbott. And Elizabeth Abbott is an award-winning and best-selling author and historian with a special interest in women's issues and the environment. History of Marriage completes her trilogy about human relationships that includes a history of celibacy and a history of mistresses. She lives in Toronto, but we're reaching her at the offices of Seven Stories Press in New York City. Elizabeth Abbott, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, I wish I would have known about your other two books. I would have, maybe we can go backwards.
Okay.
But let's start with a history of marriage. So does it go together like a horse and carriage? That sounds kind of old fashioned.
Love and marriage? As a matter of fact, love was at one point, until really well into the 18th century and even into the 19th, was regarded as a very unsound basis for marriage. And it was frowned upon because it was thought to be ephemeral. And it just wasn't sound. What marriage was about was financial arrangement. It was about combining incomes, or it was about contiguous land that would be joined by two families. Marriages were arranged by parents for financial, you know, commercial reasons.
Well, then we talk about the 19th century being the Romantic period. Is that when that all began?
It's when the idea of love as an important element in marriage, not the important driving force the way it is today, but as an element in marriage, started to develop, so that it was acceptable to take that into consideration. And it wasn't the sort of pulsing, heart-throbbing, you know, loin-throbbing love that we feel that we have to have today. It was a companionate sort of a affectionate love.
Well, marriage, it's, many people tell us, in fact, couples appear to be throughout the human experience to be the central element of all communities. And so when we have laws in the United States, I know you're from Canada, but we have laws in the United States called the Defense of Marriage Act that somehow it was felt that this institution is under assault by cannon fire. Does marriage need a defense?
No, I think that the best defense that marriage could have would be successful marriages. And the way we're going to get successful marriage isn't to impose laws. It's to explain to people what marriage is all about, and it's to make sure that they know that it's to give them a choice as to whether they want to get into it, to make them understand that the most successful marriages are ones in which people, you know, give careful consideration going into them, and they're very compatible. It's probably better if they're educated and they're a bit older, as opposed to, you know, 18 or 19. And if you parse the divorce statistics in that way, really it isn't a scary thing at all. It's if you're ill-equipped at life, you will probably be, you know, ill-equipped at marriage as well. So the more preparation you have in your life, the better your marriage will be too.
if my memory's a little better now, I think it was Sammy Kahn who wrote the lyrics for Love and Marriage, the song by that Frank Sinatra sang in 1955. So everything was sweet and romantic. And then by the late 1980s, when Married with Children comes along, the Fox sitcom, and Love and Marriage is pretty much the theme song, done in an ironic manner. What happened in 30 years? Was it just the so-called sexual revolution that sank the popular conception of marriage?
You know, the popular conception of marriage wasn't necessarily the experience of lived marriage, and people weren't feeling that within their marriages. And one thing that happened was, during World War II, when men went off to war, women were, it filled a huge gap in industry to go into the factories that men had left and that had to be staffed. And women were given a lot of encouragement. The governments of both Canada and the United States set up daycare for women, free daycare, to enable them to go into the factories and to do jobs that men had held before. They gave them special perks. Women did this through the war. They got good salaries. They had the assistance of daycare, the prestige of knowing that they were, you know, helping their country. They were being patriotic. Then after the war, the daycares were collapsed. The women were laid off their jobs. The men returned and got the jobs. And women were told that what they should be doing was being a homemaker. They should be June Cleaver with, you know, in Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
But guess what? They didn't like that. And that wasn't an experience, especially after the liberation of their war work, that Rosie the Riveter didn't want to be June Cleaver. She liked being Rosie the Riveter. She liked being more independent. And so there was an awful lot of unhappiness that was simmering, that sort of expressed itself later on in the 70s and the 80s.
So it wasn't those darn hippies that did it all.
It wasn't the hippies. The hippies didn't do that, no, I don't think.
My guest is Elizabeth Abbott, and she is the author of A History of Marriage from Same-Sex Unions to Private Vows in Common Law. We're going to get into some of that and the surprising diversity of a tradition, which we also will talk about as well. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. But marriage has always been disparaged. The formal marriage, the church and state-sanctified marriage, has always been disparaged in popular literature and humor, hasn't it? This is nothing new from the 1960s or the 1970s or even post-World War II.
It certainly isn't. Someone sent me the other day a very long piece by St. Jerome.
Okay.
From centuries ago, talking about the awful, how awful marriage was. Now, he wasn't married, obviously, but this was his observation, and people confided their experiences to him. You can find literature throughout the ages that really sounds as if it were written today. The mother-in-law jokes, the my wife will let me do anything jokes, or my husband is a baby and thinks I'm his mother jokes, and so on and so forth. There's an awful lot of reality that hasn't changed a great deal.
Well, I'm trying to think of the name of the African band, but the name of their album is called Marriage is a Problem. and living together, whether it's, a family with children or roommates or, spouse, is difficult. But has it always been so difficult, or is it seem more difficult these days?
Well, I think that we have different standards. I mean, if it was accepted for someone to boss you around and, clobber you every now and then you accepted it because that's just how it was. But if the same sort of thing is happening or even less, if you expect egalitarianism, you will be more unhappy with what you get if it doesn't quite conform to, your very high standards. So I guess that's really what it's about.
Well, this is sort of an old-fashioned way to formulate things, but I used to say this maybe back in the 20th century, that the women were reading Ms. magazine and the guys were still reading Playboy. So there was a different consciousness growing among women, but not among men. And now with such diverse forms of information and ideas, I'm not quite sure where people are getting all their belief systems from. But I suspect a lot of that still happens. And that may be what accounts for half of marriages in the States going bust, because women just won't put up with a lot anymore.
You know, first of all, two things. One, I think that the same women who were reading Ms. back in the 60s have produced a generation of young men who are pretty good. they're really not, you know, they're really quite sensitized to women's needs and so on. I'm the mother of a 35-year-old married son whom I'm really proud of in terms of, you know, how he, not 100%, but 98% proud of how he is. I think he's pretty typical of young men that are much, much more competent as than their fathers were, let us say. And the other thing is that the divorce statistics of 50% that we terrify ourselves with are just the raw statistics. If you parse it more minutely than that, you'll see that people who are better educated and professionally established and so on will have a better, you know, go of it than people who are not in that fortunate position.
Well, that's actually really unfortunate because in other words, in this society, it's true on every level. The poorer you are, the more travesties that you suffer.
Yeah, look, you know, living together. And I'm not talking about whether you're married or not, just the actual fact of living with someone is a very difficult thing. And if you have all the stresses of not good jobs, of not enough money, of things going wrong that you haven't got the resources to deal with, it will be much more stressful, obviously. It's really true that if you have more money, you don't have to have a zillion dollars, but you have enough a comfort level will certainly make your life much easier. And your relationship will be easier. Even in terms of privacy, for example, if you have more space, if you're not all squished together, if you don't have incredible worry, you know, chronic worry about bill paying or something, it will be easier. You'll have a better relationship.
Elizabeth Abbott is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. She's written a history of marriage from same-sex unions to private vows and common law, the surprising diversity of a tradition. We really haven't gotten to much of the subtitle. By the way, this is published by Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com or Elizabeth's website, which is Elizabeth Abbott, two T's at the end, .ca. Okay, and let's talk about the surprising diversity of a tradition. We're told that a marriage is a man and a woman sanctified best by church, but at least by state. Now, that has not always been the case, obviously.
No, I mean, first of all, the marriage used to, in colonial North America, where there were often not clergy, there was a thing called self-marriage. You just, you know, lived together and it became accepted as a real marriage because that was the best that you could do and that was understood. That's one example. Also in North America, when European colonists came, they discovered that many of the natives had a different understanding of gender and that there were sort of the third sex, people who were not strictly male or strictly female, and they could marry, and there were different sorts of rights regarding these people. So that, and the colonists were extremely surprised by that. What is that about?
And then
now we're in Canada. We have, as of 2005, we have legalized gay marriage, so that men and women can a man can marry a man, and a woman can marry a woman.
Well, and what? And the whole country must have fallen apart, and we haven't heard about it.
Well, guess what? It hasn't been, and in fact, it has. And many of the people who go to get married there are American too. But what has happened is that there are more children being adopted by gay couples. But a lot of people who are gay wish to, you know, have a family life that in every way resembles other family lives, except for the same sex partners. And we're discovering, for example, that lesbian parents turn out to be probably the best kind of parents. This is pretty new scholarship because it's a new phenomenon, but we are finding that out. And so that there are all sorts of changes, but another change is that it shores up, it reinforces marriage. So here was a complete group of people who were excluded from marriage, and now they are able to marry, and not, you know, a certain number wish to, so that there is a strengthening of marriage.
How about in the Western tradition from Europe back into the Middle Ages and before? What sort of traditions were present there, and do they mirror what we have here now?
There were all different ones that probably the biggest difference or the biggest change was that in Western Europe, marriages were arranged so that the actual spouses didn't have a great deal of say in the matter. I'm thinking of a case in England in the 15th century in which a father arranged with another man to marry off his daughter. And the only thing is he had two daughters, and he didn't put in which one. He decided to wait until the last minute, and sort of on the day of or the day before, he would decide which daughter was going to get married. This is the sort of way that, you know, that marriage was conceived. It had really nothing, very little to do with the individual. It was seen as a family affair. And you had to be, you know, think of yourself as part of the family. You couldn't think about your own needs and your own desires and so on.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Abbott, you mentioned earlier that many times or most times that these arranged marriages were about property and status and all that. And certainly they have that, not so much property, but links between people in pre-industrial society, but in Europe, say in the Middle Ages, what about the peasants? They didn't have much at stake to share or did they?
You know, they might have. It depends. There were really badly off peasants, and there were, you know, better off peasants. They might have land that was, you know, fields that were adjacent that might be a good thing to, you know, to unite them. There might be a small business. There might be a dairy. There might be someone who had a leather tannery and someone else who had cows. All sorts of things like that. If someone might owe money and to acquit a debt, he might say, "Well, I've got this daughter," or you know, then you could have her for your son. All sorts of reasons like that. But probably if you were really, for the very, very poor, there really was less at stake. So it was more, they were more likely to be able to make those choices for themselves because it didn't really matter that much.
Well, conservatives, and by the nature of the description of their politics, they want to conserve what is, and they say things like marriage are carved in stone. We've carved it into a statute. In the United States, the Defense of Marriage Act, so-called DOMA, whereas in Canada, where you live, there's actually a national law permitting it. So the laws change, and maybe you could speak a little to how the American laws have changed in terms of property rights for women. Let's just start with that one, because I was going to say, and we could go on to race within marriage as well, which is, I think, always surprising, the aspects of that. But there's been, even in the 20th century, great changes on property within married families, correct?
Yes, there was. Women used to be, and this is true for all countries in the, you know, in the Western world, they were covered by a law of couverture, which means that the man basically was, you know, the romantic thing, you and I are one.
Right.
Well, that was true legally, and so he and she were both him. So he got to vote. And she didn't. He did the voting. He did the looking after the money. Even if she worked, and for example, if she wrote novels the way some women did, or she wrote, or she, you know, raised chickens and collected, sold eggs, he had the right to the money and she did not. And so that property rights made a huge difference. And another, at the same time, so in terms of sustaining a marriage, how could you think of leaving a marriage if you were going to then have nothing? The other thing was that, and this is not well known at all, is that until really the 20th century, if men, if there was a separation, men got custody of the child.
Hmm.
It was almost always the case that the man would get custody of the child, not the woman. As a result of which, in reality, a woman in a very unhappy marriage would nonetheless almost, you know, very few of them wished to risk losing their children. And then becoming absolutely destitute because they would get nothing because they didn't have property rights. So when women got property rights, and that was in the 19th century that started, it really did change the face of marriage as well.
Was that by law?
I'm sorry?
Was that, did law
determine that? Laws started being passed in different jurisdictions to give women more control, you know, married women, to give them property rights and so on. Not equality, but certainly making, you know, starting down the path towards women being, you know, real live people.
Yeah. Well, that's always good. A History of Marriage is the book published by Seven Stories Press. My guest for just a few minutes more is Elizabeth Abbott. Talk to us, if you would, about race and marriage. You're from Canada, but where it was most shameful, of course, was in the United States till up to, I think it was 1967. There were laws against African Americans and whites marrying.
Yes, and that of course, stemmed from slave times, because if that had been, and there were black-white marriages during slave times, and some of, there's a little bit about that in the book, but the laws against miscegenation basically were to maintain white superiority, because the very strong feeling behind it was, if there was intermarriage, then it was all over, then we're not superior, because we can marry them, my God. And so it took Mildred Loving, who was an African-American woman, and her husband, Richard Loving, who they had grown up in the same small town. They got married, and they were basically told that they'd go to jail if they didn't leave the jurisdiction because they had miscegenated. But they rebelled, and they took it through. They were a modest couple, but didn't sit right with them at all. And they took it to courts, and they had help. And it ended up that the law, the Supreme Court of the United States finally overturned all the miscegenation laws of the United States. And so black and white could legally marry everywhere after that. It took years.
Well, interestingly, in Massachusetts, there was a case. I read this book. I can't remember the author. The book was 1919, about that incredible year. And there was a couple, a white woman married a black man, and she had just a little bit of money, and the woman was eventually put in a mental institution, even though it was legal. There weren't laws against miscegenation, mixed marriages in Massachusetts, so they had their ways. Well, let's go to gay marriage, and just in a couple minutes we have left. And as you said, Elizabeth Abbott, in Canada, it is now legal. The United States still has the Defense of Marriage Act, yet I just saw statistics recently, 53% of all Americans support the right of anyone to marry, and when you start getting down people below 30, it's way up. So is this traditional view of marriage on the way out?
I think so, and I think that even some very conservative people, I don't want to say a name in case I've got it wrong, but that they are understanding that gay marriage actually is an expression of support for a traditional institution. So in that sense, it's actually a good thing for conservatives. And I think that the more of them that see that, the more widespread that view will be. Young people definitely, change our way of thinking about things, and they do not have our way of the old-fashioned way of thinking. And they don't, they're much more open to differences. They're much more accepting. And so I think it's really just a matter of time before DOMA, withers away, crumbles away.
Well, that would be a good thing for sure. Often when I do a phone-in talk show, I ask people to call and I say, well, can anybody show how this, maybe you don't like it or it conflicts with your religious values, your own religious values, not yours, but, a caller. But how does it harm anyone else who's married or anyone else who may want to get married to somebody of the opposite sex? And in like this case that's been heard about this proposition outlawing gay marriage in California, nobody can come up with anything where the harm is.
Yeah, exactly. It's extreme terror. It's some sort of almost pathological fear of something, an inability to, to think something through. And see, it really doesn't harm. So you don't have to go and get married to someone of the same sex. It's simply that you are allowing people to participate in this institution that you are so worried about that is dying, and they wish to help it not die. So how does it make sense to ban them from it?
And didn't the Beatles sing, "All We Need Is Love," and that they're all about love? I mean, when you see these scenes of gay men or gay women after they've been married, it's not just that they married couples are almost, you know, 99.9% happy at the altar, but it's sort of like an affirmation, I think. Yes, you are a human being, and I think that's important.
Yeah, you know what? Mildred Loving, who is, you know, a huge name in the miscegenation, in having brought down miscegenation laws, also has come out officially in support of gay marriage, and she said people should be allowed to marry who love each other, and that's all. And it shouldn't matter whether they are black or white or gay or same sex or whatever. It should be their right. So I thought that was, she extrapolated from her experience to those of other people, and I think that that's a very strong endorsement for it.
I think it's a perfect way to end the interview, too. And yet, the story goes on. We've just barely scratched the surface. I would highly recommend A History of Marriage, from Same-Sex Unions to Private Vows and Common Law, the Surprising Diversity of a Tradition. My guest has been Elizabeth Abbott. Thanks so much for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call. Everything that rocks on your smartphone. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Download from the App Store or Google Play Store now, or click the link at WRIF.com. Join WRIF's Dave and Chuck the Freak for a St. Patrick's Day live broadcast from Dooley's on Gratiot in Roseville. Doors open 6 a.m. Green beer, huge tent, Irish food, and entertainment. Dooley's, Gratiot, north of 13 Mile in Roseville. Details at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Mind Flowers in action. The Riff.
You have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once. I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm crazy.